before Ortega, to unholster the elderly 45 Schofield on his belt and start shooting. I'm in here, Rennie's out there. As far as he's concerned, I'm sure it's all good.
Shut up!
Manuel screamed. We're all in here. All under the fucking dome. Alden don't do nothing but drink. The boy that's left won't eat, and Ms. Dinsmore never stops crying over Rory. Jack Evans blew his brains out. Do you know that? And those military pukes out there can't think of anything better to do than sling mud. A lot of lies and trumped-up stories while you start supermarket riots, and then burn down our newspaper, probably so Ms. Sumway couldn't publish what you are.
Barbie kept silent. He thought that one word spoken in his own defense would get him shot for sure.
This is how they get any politician they don't like, Manuel said. They want a serial killer and a rapist, one who rapes the dead, in charge instead of a Christian. That's a new low.
Manuel drew his gun, lifted it, pointed it through the bars. To Barbie, the hole at the end looked as big as a tunnel entrance.
If the dome comes down before you've been stood up against the nearest wall and ventilated, Manuel continued, I'll take a minute to do the job myself. I'm head of the line, and right now in the mill, the line waiting to do you is a long one.
Barbie kept silent and waited to die, or keep on drawing breath. Rose Twitchell's BLTs were trying to crowd back up his throat and choke him.
We're trying to survive, and all they can do is dirty up the man who's keeping this town out of chaos.
He abruptly shoved the oversized pistol back into its holster.
Fuck you. You're not worth it.
He turned and strode back toward the stairs, head down and shoulders hunched. Barbie leaned back against the wall and let out a breath. There was sweat on his forehead. The hand he lifted to wipe it off was shaking. 3. When Romeo Burpee's van turned into the McClatchy driveway, Claire rushed out of the house. She was weeping.
Mom!
Joe shouted, and was out even before Romy could come to a complete stop. The others piled out after.
Mom, what's wrong?
Nothing, Claire sobbed, grabbing him and hugging him. There's going to be a visitor's day. On Friday. Joey, I think we might get to see your dad.
Joe let out a cheer and danced around her. Benny hugged Nori and took the opportunity to steal a quick kiss, Rusty observed. Cheeky little devil.
Take me to the hospital, Romy, Rusty said. He waved to Claire and the kids as they backed down the driveway.
He was glad to get away from Mrs. McClatchy without having to talk to her. Mom vision might work on PAs as well.
And could you do me a favor and talk English instead of that comic book on Parl shit while you do it?
Some people have no cultural heritage to fall back on, Romy said, and are thus jealous of those who do.
Yeah, and your mother wears galoshes, Rusty said.
That's true, but only when it rains, huh?
Rusty's cell phone chimed once, a text message. He flipped it open and read, Meeting at 21:30. Congo Parsonage. Be there or be square. J.W.
Romy,
he said, closing his phone. Assuming I survive the Rennies, would you consider attending a meeting with me tonight? 4. At the hospital, Ginny met him in the lobby.
It's Rennie Day at Kathy Russell, she announced, looking as if this did not exactly displease her. Thurse Marshall has been in to see them both. Rusty, that man, is a gift from God. He clearly doesn't like Junior. He and Frankie were the ones who roughed him up out of the pond, but he was totally professional. The guy's wasted in some college English department. He should be doing this.
She lowered her voice.
He's better than me, and way better than Twitch.
Where is he now?
Went back to where he's living to see that young girlfriend of his and the two children they took on.
He seems to genuinely care about the kids, too.
Oh, my goodness, Ginny's in love, Rusty said, grinning.
Don't be juvenile, she glared at him.
What rooms are the Rennies in?
Junior in 7, senior in 19. Senior came in with that guy Thibodeau, but must have sent him off to run errands.
because he was on his own when he went down to see his kid. She smiled cynically.
He didn't visit long. Mostly he's been on that cell phone of his. The kid just sits. Although he's rational again. He wasn't when Henry Morrison brought him in.
Big Jim's arrhythmia. How are we with that?
Thurston got it quieted down.
For the time being, Rusty thought. And not without satisfaction. When the Valium wears off, he'll recommence the old cardiac jitterbug.
Go see the kid first,
Ginny said. They were alone in the lobby, but she kept her voice low-pitched.
I don't like him. I've never liked him. But I feel sorry for him now. I don't think he's got long.
Did Thurston say anything about Junior's condition to Rennie?
Yes, that the problem was potentially serious. But apparently not as serious as all those calls he's making. Probably someone told him about Visitor's Day on Friday. Rennie's pissed about it.
Rusty thought of the box on Black Ridge. Just a thin rectangle, with an area of less than 50 square inches. And still, he hadn't been able to lift it. Or even budge it. He also thought of the laughing leatherheads he'd briefly glimpsed.
Some people just don't approve of visitors, he said. 5. How are you feeling, Junior?
Okay. Better.
He sounded listless. He was wearing a hospital johnny and sitting by the window. The light was merciless on his haggard face. He looked like a road-hard 40-year-old.
Tell me what happened before you passed out.
I was going to school, then I went to Angie's house instead. I wanted to tell her to make it up with Frank. He's been majorly bumming.
Rusty considered asking if Junior knew Frank and Angie were both dead. Then didn't. What was the point? Instead, he asked,
You were going to school? What about the dome?
Oh, right.
The same listless, affectless voice.
I forgot about that.
How old are you, son?
21?
What was your mother's name? Junior considered this.
Jason Gamby, he said at last, then laughed shrilly.
But the listless, haggard expression on his face never changed.
When did the dome drop down?
Saturday.
And how long ago was that? Junior frowned.
A week, he said at last. Then 2 weeks. It's been a while, for sure.
He turned at last to Rusty. His eyes were shining with the Valium Thirst Marshall had injected.
Did Barbie put you up to all these questions?
He killed them.
You know.
He nodded.
We found his gog bags.
A pause.
Dog tags.
Barbie didn't put me up to anything, Rusty said. He's in jail.
Pretty soon he'll be in hell,
Junior said with dry matter-of-factness. We're going to try him
and execute him. My dad said so. There's no death penalty in Maine, but he says these are wartime conditions. Egg salad has too many calories.
That's true, Rusty said. He had brought a stethoscope, a blood pressure cuff, and an ophthalmoscope. Now he wrapped the cuff around Junior's arm.
Can you name the last three presidents in order, Junior?
Sure. Bush, push, and tush.
He laughed wildly, but still with no facial expression. Junior's BP was 147 over 120. Rusty had been prepared for worse.
Do you remember who came in to see you before I did?
Yeah. The old guy me and Frankie found at the pond just before we found the kids. I hope those kids are all right. They were totally cute.
Do you remember their names?
Aiden and Alice Appleton. We went to the club and that girl with the red hair jerked me off under the table. Thought she was going to ferret right off before she was fun.
A pause.
Done.
Uh-huh.
Rusty employed the ophthalmoscope. Junior's right eye was fine. The optic disc of the left was bulging. A condition known as papilledema. It was a common symptom of advanced brain tumors and the attendant swelling.
See anything green, McQueen?
Nope. Rusty put the ophthalmoscope down, then held his index finger in front of Junior's face. I want you to touch my finger with your finger, then touch your nose. Junior did so. Rusty began to move his finger slowly back and forth. Keep going. Junior succeeded in going from the moving finger to his nose once. Then he hit the finger but touched his cheek instead. The third time, he missed the finger and touched his right eyebrow.
Booyah! You want more? I can do it all day, you know.
I'm going to send Ginny Tomlinson in with a prescription for you.
After I get it, can I go roam? Home, I mean.
You're staying overnight with us, Junior, for observation.
But I'm all right, aren't I?
I had one of my headaches before. I mean, a real blinder, but it's gone. I'm okay, right?
I can't tell you anything right now, Rusty said. I want to talk with Thurston Marshall and look at some books.
Man, that guy's no doctor. He's an English teacher.
Maybe so, but he treated you okay. Better than you and Frank treated him, is my understanding. Junior waved a dismissing hand.
We were just playing.
Besides,
we treated those Rids kite, didn't we?
Can't argue with you there. For now, Junior, just relax. Watch some TV, why don't you? Junior considered this, then asked,
What's for supper?
6. Under the circumstances, the only thing Rusty could think of to reduce the swelling in what passed for Junior Rennie's brain was IV mannitol. He pulled the chart out of the door and saw a note attached to it in an unfamiliar looping scrawl. Dear Dr. Everett, what do you think about mannitol for this patient? I cannot order, have no idea of the correct amount. Thurs. Rusty jotted down the dose. Ginny was right. Thurston Marshall was good. 7. The door to Big Jim's room was open, but the room was empty. Rusty heard the man's voice coming from the late Dr. Haskell's favorite snoozery. Rusty walked down to the lounge. He did not think to take Big Jim's chart, an oversight he would come to regret. Big Jim was fully dressed and sitting by the window with his phone to his ear, even though the sign on the wall showed a bright red cell phone with a red X over it for the reading impaired. Rusty thought it would give him great pleasure to order Big Jim to terminate his call. It might not be the most politic way to start what was going to be a combination exam discussion, but he meant to do it. He started forward, then stopped. Cold. A clear memory arose. Not being able to sleep, getting up for a piece of Linda's cranberry orange bread, hearing Audrey whining softly from the girls' room, going down there to check the J's. Sitting on Jenny's bed beneath Hannah Montana, her guardian angel. Why had this memory been so slow in coming? Why not during his meeting with Big Jim in Big Jim's home study? Because then I didn't know about the murders. I was fixated on the propane. And because Janelle wasn't having a seizure, she was just in REM sleep. Talking in her sleep. He has a golden baseball, Daddy. It's a bad baseball. Even last night in the mortuary, that memory hadn't resurfaced. Only now, when it was 2:30 late. But think what it means. That gadget up on Black Ridge may only be putting out limited radiation, but it's broadcasting something else. Call it induced precognition. Call it something that doesn't even have a name. But whatever you call it, it's there. And if Jenny was right about the golden baseball, then all the kids who've been making Sybil-like pronouncements about a Halloween disaster may be right, too. But does it mean on that exact day? Or could it be earlier? Rusty thought the latter. For a town full of kids overexcited about trick-or-treating, it was Halloween already.
I don't care what you've got on, Stuart, Big Jim was saying.
3 milligrams of Valium didn't seem to have mellowed him out. He sounded as fabulously grumpy as ever.
You infernal, get up there and take Roger with you.
Huh?
What?
He listened.
I shouldn't even have to tell you. Haven't you been watching the cotton picking TV? If it gives you any sass, you...
He looked up and saw Rusty in the doorway. For just a moment, Big Jim had the startled look of a man replaying his conversation and trying to decide how much the newcomer might have overheard.
"Stuart, someone's here. I'll get back to you. And when I do, you better tell me what I want to hear."
He broke the connection without saying goodbye, held the phone up to Rusty, and bared his small upper teeth in a smile.
I know, very naughty. But town business won't wait.
He sighed.
It's not easy to be the one everybody's dependent on, especially when you're not feeling well.
Must be difficult, Rusty agreed.
God helps me. Would you like to know the philosophy I live by, pal?
No.
Sure. When God closes a door, he opens a window.
Do you think so?
I know so. And the one thing I always try to remember is that when you pray for what you want, God turns a deaf ear. But when you pray for what you need, he's all ears.
Uh-huh. Rusty entered the lounge. On the wall, the TV was tuned to CNN. The sound was muted, but there was a still photo of James Rennie Sr. looming behind the talking head. Black and white, not flattering. One of Big Jim's fingers was raised, and so was his upper lip. Not in a smile, but in a remarkably canine sneer. The super beneath read, "Was Dome Town Drug Haven?" The picture switched to a Jim Rennie used car ad, the annoying one that always ended with one of the salespeople, never Big Jim himself, screaming, "You'll be wheelin' because Big Jim's dealin'." Big Jim gestured to it and smiled sadly.
"You see what Barbara's friends on the outside are doing to me? Well, what's the surprise? When Christ came to redeem mankind, they made him carry his own cross to Calvary Hill, where he died in blood and dust."
Rusty reflected, and not for the first time, what a strange drug Valium was. He didn't know if there really was Veritas in vino, but there was plenty of it in Valium. When you gave it to people, especially by IV, you often heard exactly what they thought of themselves.
Rusty pulled up a chair and readied the stethoscope for action.
"Lift up your shirt."
When Big Jim put down his cell phone to do it, Rusty slipped it into his breast pocket.
"I'll just take this, shall I? I'll leave it at the lobby desk. That's an okay area for cell phones. The chairs aren't as well padded as these, but they're still not bad."
He expected Big Jim to protest, maybe explode, but he didn't so much as peep. Only exposed a bulging Buddha belly and large, soft man-breasts above it. Rusty bent forward and had a listen. It was far better than he'd expected. He would have been happy with 110 beats a minute, plus moderate premature ventriculation. Instead, Big Jim's pump was loping along at 90, with no misbeats at all.
"I'm feeling a lot better," Big Jim said. "It was stress. I've been under terrible stress. I'm going to take another hour or two to rest right here. Do you realize you can see all of downtown from this window, pal? And I'm going to visit with Junior one more time. After that, I'll just check myself out, and
it isn't just stress. You're overweight and out of shape."
Big Jim bared his upper teeth in that bogus smile.
"I've been running a business in a town, pal. Both in the black, by the way. That leaves little time for treadmills and stairmasters and such."
"You presented with PAT 2 years ago, Rennie. That's paroxysmal atrial tachycardia."
"I know what it is. I went to WebMD, and it said healthy people often experience."
"Ron Haskell told you in no uncertain terms to get your weight under control, to get the arrhythmia under control with medication, and if medication wasn't effective, to explore surgical options to correct the underlying problem."
Big Jim had begun to look like an unhappy child imprisoned in a high chair.
"God told me not to. God said no pacemaker. And God was right. Duke Perkins had a pacemaker, and look what happened to him."
"Not to mention his widow," Rusty said softly. "Bad luck for her, too. She must have just been in the wrong place at the wrong time." Big Jim regarded him, little pig eyes calculating. Then he looked up at the ceiling.
"Lights are on again, aren't they? I got you your propane like you asked.
Some people don't have much gratitude. Of course a man in my position gets used to that.
We'll be out again by tomorrow night.
Big Jim shook his head. By tomorrow night you'll have enough LP to keep this place running until Christmas if it's necessary. It's my promise to you for having such a wonderful bedside manner and being such an all-around good fellow.
I do have trouble being grateful when people return what was mine to begin with. I'm funny that way.
Oh, so now you're equating yourself with the hospital, Big Jim snorted.
Why not? You just equated yourself with Christ. Let's return to your medical situation, shall we?
Big Jim flapped his large, blunt-fingered hands disgustedly.
Valium isn't a cure. If you walk out of here, you could be firing misbeats again by 5 p.m. Or just vapor lock completely. The bright side is that you could be meeting your savior before it gets dark here in town.
And what would you recommend?
Rennie spoke calmly. He had regained his composure. I could give you something that would probably take care of the problem, at least short term. It's a drug.
What drug?
But there's a price.
I knew it, Big Jim said softly. I knew you were on Barbara's side the day you came to my office, with your give me this and give me that.
The only thing Rusty had asked for was propane, but he ignored that. How did you know Barbara had a side, then? The murders hadn't been discovered, so how did you know he had a side? Big Jim's eyes gleamed with amusement, or paranoia, or both.
I have my little ways, pal. So what's the price? What would you like me to trade you for the drug that will keep me from having a heart attack?
And before Rusty could respond,
let me guess, you want Barbara's freedom, don't you?
No, this town would lynch him the minute he stepped outside.
Big Jim laughed. Every now and then you show a lick of sense.
I want you to step down. Sanders, too. Let Andrea Grinnell take over with Julia Shumway to help her out until Andy kicks her drug habit.
Big Jim laughed louder this time and slapped his thigh for good measure. I thought Cox was bad. He wanted the one with the big titties to help Andrea. But you're ever so much worse. Shumway? That rhymes with witch couldn't administrate herself out of a paper bag.
I know you killed Coggins. He hadn't meant to say that. But it was out before he could pull it back. And what harm? It was just the two of them. Unless you counted CNN's John Roberts, looking down from the TV on the wall. And besides, the results were worth it. For the first time since he had accepted the reality of the dome, Big Jim was rocked. He tried to keep his face neutral and failed.
You're crazy.
You know I'm not. Last night I went to the Bowie funeral home and examined the bodies of the four murder victims.
You had no right to do that. You're no pathologist. You're not even a cotton-picking doctor.
Relax, Rennie. Count to 10. Remember your heart. Rusty paused. On second thought, fuck your heart. After the mess you left behind and the one you're making now, fuck your heart. There were marks all over Coggins' face and head. Very atypical marks, but easily identifiable. Stitch marks. I have no doubt they'll match the souvenir baseball I saw on your desk.
That doesn't mean anything.
But Rennie glanced toward the open bathroom door. It means plenty. Especially when you consider the other bodies were dumped in the same place. To me, that suggests the killer of Coggins was the killer of the others. I think it was you. Or maybe you and Junior. Were you a father and son tag team? Was that it?
I refuse to listen to this.
He started to get up. Rusty pushed him back down. It was surprisingly easy.
Stay where you are, Rennie shouted. Gosh damn it, just stay where you are.
Rusty said, why did you kill him? Did he threaten to blow the whistle on your drug operation? Was he part of it?
Stay where you are, Rennie repeated,
although Rusty had already sat back down. It did not occur to him then that Rennie might not have been speaking to him. I can keep this quiet, Rusty said, and I can give you something that will take care of your PAT better than Valium. The quid pro quo is that you step down. Announce your resignation for medical reasons in favor of Andrea tomorrow night at the big meeting. You'll go out a hero.
There was no way he could refuse, Rusty thought. The man was backed into a corner. Rennie turned to the open bathroom door again and said,
"Now you can come out."
Carter Thibodeau and Freddie Denton emerged from the bathroom where they had been hiding and listening. 8.
"God damn,"
Stuart Bowie said. He and his brother were in the basement workroom of the funeral parlor. Stuart had been doing a makeup job on Arletta Coombs, the mill's latest suicide, and the Bowie funeral home's latest customer.
"God damn, son of a bitch, fucking shit monkey!"
He dropped his cell phone onto the counter and from the wide front pocket of his rubberized green apron removed a package of peanut butter-flavored Ritz Bits. Stuart always ate when he was upset. He had always been messy with food. The pigs ate here, their dad was wont to say when young Stewie left the table, and now Ritz crumbs showered down on Arletta's upturned face, which was far from peaceful. If she'd thought quaffing liquid plumber would be a quick and painless way to escape the dome, she had been badly deceived. Darn stuff had eaten all the way through her stomach and out through her back.
"What's wrong?"
Fern asked.
"Why did I ever get involved with fucking Rennie?" "The money." "What good's money now?"
Stuart raved.
"What am I going to do? Want a fucking shopping spree at Burpee's department store? That'd give me a fucking hard-on for sure."
He yanked open the elderly widow's mouth and slammed the remaining Ritz Bits inside.
"There you go, bitch. It's fucking snack time."
Stuart snatched up his cell, hit the contacts button, and selected a number.
"If he isn't there,"
he said, perhaps to Fern, more likely to himself, "I'm going to go out there, find him, and stick one of his own chickens right up his fucking ass." But Roger Killian was there, and in his goddamn chicken house. Stuart could hear them clucking. He could also hear the swooping violins of Mantovani coming through the chicken house sound system. When the kids were out there, it was Metallica or Pantera.
"No. Roger, it's Stewie. You straight, brother?"
"Pretty,"
Roger agreed, which probably meant he'd been smoking glass, but what the fuck.
"Get down here to town. Meet me and Fern at the motor pool. We're going to take two of them big trucks, the ones with the hoists, out there to WCIK. All the propane's got to be moved back to town. We can't do it in one day, but Jim says we got to make a start. Tomorrow, I'll recruit 6 or 7 more guys we can trust. Some of them Jim's goddamn private army, if he'll spare 'em. And we'll finish up."
"Oh, Stuart, no. I got to feed these chickens. The boys I got left has all gone to be cops."
Which means, Stuart thought, you want to sit in that little office of yours, smoking glass and listening to shit music and looking at lesbian makeout videos on your computer. He didn't know how you could get horny with the aroma of chicken shit so thick you could cut it with a knife. But Roger Killian managed.
"This is not a volunteer mission, my brother. I got ordered and I'm ordering you 30 minutes. And if you do happen to see any of your kids hanging around, you shanghai 'em along."
He hung up before Roger could recommence his whiny shit and for a moment just stood there fuming. The last thing on earth he wanted to do with what remained of this Wednesday afternoon was muscle propane tanks into trucks. But that was what he was going to be doing, all right. Yes, he was. He snatched the spray hose from the sink, stuck it between Arletta Coombs' dentures, and triggered it. It was a high-pressure hose, and the corpse jumped on the table.
"Wash them crackers down, Grandma," he snarled. "Wouldn't want you to choke." "Stop,"
Fern cried.
"It'll squirt out the hole in it."
Too late. 9. Big Jim looked at Rusty with a see-what-it-gets-you smile. Then he turned to Carter and Freddie Denton.
"Did you fellows hear Mr. Everett try to coerce me?"
"We sure did," Freddie said.
"Did you hear him threaten to withhold certain life-saving medication if I refuse to step down?"
"Yeah,"
Carter said,
and favored Rusty with a black look.
Rusty wondered how he ever could have been so stupid. It's been a long day. Chalk it up to that.
The medication in question might have been a drug called Verapamil, which that fellow with the long hair administered by IV.
Big Jim exposed his small teeth in another unpleasant smile. Verapamil.
For the first time, Rusty cursed himself for not taking Big Jim's chart from its slot on the door and examining it. It would not be the last.
What kind of crimes have we got here, do you suppose?
Big Jim asked.
Criminal threatening?
Sure, and extortion, Freddy said.
Hell with that. It was attempted murder, Carter said.
And who do you suppose put him up to it?
Barbie, Carter said, and slugged Rusty in the mouth.
Rusty had no sense of it coming, and didn't even begin to get his guard up. He staggered backward, hit one of the chairs, and fell into it sideways with his mouth bleeding.
You got that resisting arrest, Big Jim remarked. But it's not enough. Put him on the floor, fellows. I want him on the floor.
Rusty tried to run, but barely got out of the chair before Carter grabbed one of his arms and spun him around. Freddy put a foot behind his legs. Carter pushed. Like kids in the schoolyard, Rusty thought, as he toppled over. Carter dropped down beside him. Rusty got in one blow. It landed on Carter's left cheek. Carter shook it off impatiently, like a man ridding himself of a troublesome fly. A moment later, he was sitting on Rusty's chest, grinning down at him. Yes, just like in the schoolyard, only with no playground monitor to break things up. He turned his head to Rennie, who was now on his feet.
You don't want to do this, he panted.
His heart was thudding hard. He could barely get enough breath to feed it. Thibodeau was very heavy. Freddy Denton was on his knees beside the two of them. To Rusty, he looked like the ref in one of those put-up job wrestling matches.
But I do, Everett, Big Jim said. In fact, God bless you, I have to. Freddy, snag my cell phone. It's in his breast pocket, and I don't want it getting broken. The cotton picker stole it. You can add that to his bill when you get him to the station.
Other people know, Rusty said.
He had never felt so helpless, and so stupid. Telling himself that he wasn't the first to underestimate James Rennie Sr. did not help.
Other people know what you did.
Perhaps, Big Jim said, but who are they? Other friends of Dale Barbara, that's who. The ones who started the food riot, the ones who burned down the newspaper office, the ones who set the dome going in the first place, I have no doubt. Some sort of government experiment, that's what I think. But we're not rats in a box, are we?
Are we, Carter?
No.
Freddy, what are you waiting for?
Freddy had been listening to Big Jim with an expression that said, now I get it. He took Big Jim's cell phone from Rusty's breast pocket and tossed it onto one of the sofas. Then he turned back to Rusty.
How long have you been planning it? How long have you been planning to lock us up in town so you could see what we'd do?
Freddy, listen to yourself, Rusty said.
The words came out in a wheeze. God, but Thibodeau was heavy.
That's crazy. It makes no sense. Can't you see the...
Hold his hand on the floor, Big Jim said. The left one.
Freddy did as he was ordered. Rusty tried to fight, but with Thibodeau pinning his arms, he had no leverage.
I'm sorry to do this, pal, but the people of this town have to understand we're in control of the terrorist element.
Rennie could say he was sorry all he wanted, but in the instant before he brought the heel of his shoe and all of his 230 pounds down on Rusty's clenched left hand, Rusty saw a different motive poking out the front of the second selectman's gabardine trousers. He was enjoying this, and not just in a cerebral sense. Then the heel was pressing and grinding, hard, harder, hardest. Big Jim's face was clenched with effort. Sweat stood out under his eyes. His tongue was clamped between his teeth. Don't scream, Rusty thought. It'll bring Ginny, and then she'll be in the cooking pot, too. Also, he wants you to. Don't give him the satisfaction. But when he heard the first snap from under Big Jim's heel, he did scream. He couldn't help it. There was another snap. Then a third. Big Jim stepped back, satisfied.
Get him on his feet and take him to jail. Let him visit with his friend.
Freddy was examining Rusty's hand, which was already swelling. Three of the four fingers were bent badly out of true.
Busted, he said, with great satisfaction.
Ginny appeared in the lounge doorway, her eyes huge.
What in God's name are you doing? arresting this bastard for extortion, criminal withholding, and attempted murder, Freddy Denton said as Carter hauled Rusty Everett to his feet. And that's just a start. He resisted, and we subdued him. Please, step aside, ma'am. You're nuts, Ginny cried. Rusty, your hand.
I'm all right, call Linda. Tell her these thugs. He got no further. Carter seized him by the neck and ran him out the door with his head bent down. In his ear, Carter whispered,
If I was sure that old guy knew as much about doctrine as you, I'd kill you myself.
All this in 4 days and change, Rusty marveled, as Carter forced him down the hallway, staggering and bent almost double by the grip on his neck. His left hand was no longer a hand, only a bellowing chunk of pain below his wrist. Just 4 days and change. He wondered if the Leatherheads, whatever or whoever they might be, were enjoying the show. 10. It was the late afternoon before Linda finally came across the mill's librarian. Lissa was biking back toward town along Route 117. She said she'd been talking to the sentries out of the dome, trying to glean further information about Visitor's Day.
They are not supposed to schmooze with the townies, but some will, she said. Especially if you leave the top 3 buttons on your blouse undone. That seems to be a real conversation starter. With the army guys, anyway. The Marines. I think I could take off all my clothes and dance the Macarena, and they still wouldn't say boo. Those boys seem immune to sex appeal.
She smiled.
Not that I'll ever be mistaken for Kate Winslet. Did you pick up any interesting gossip? Nope.
Lissa was straddling her bike and looking in at Linda through the passenger window.
They don't know squat. But they're awfully concerned about us. I was touched by that. And they're hearing as many rumors as we are. One of them asked me if it was true that over 100 people had committed suicide already. Can you get in the car with me for a minute?
Alyssa's smile broadened.
Am I being arrested?
There's something I want to talk to you about. Alyssa put down the kickstand of her bike and got in, first moving Linda's citation clipboard and a non-functioning radar gun out of the way. Linda told her about the clandestine visit to the funeral home and what they'd found there, then about the proposed meeting at the parsonage. Alyssa's response was immediate and vehement.
I'll be there. You just try to keep me away.
The radio cleared its throat then, and Stacy came on.
Unit 4, break, break, break.
Linda grabbed the mic. It wasn't Rusty she was thinking of. It was the girls.
This is 4, Stacy, go.
What Stacy Moggin said when she came back changed Linda's unease to outright terror.
I've got something bad to tell you, Lynn. I'd tell you to brace yourself, but I don't think you can brace yourself for a thing like this. Rusty's been arrested. What?
Linda nearly screamed, but only to Lissa. She didn't depress the send button on the side of the mic.
They've put him downstairs in the coop with Barbie. He's all right, but it looks to me like he's got a broken hand. He was holding it against his chest, and it was all swollen.
She lowered her voice.
It happened resisting arrest, they said. Over.
This time Linda remembered to key the mic.
I'll be right there. Tell him I'm coming. Over. I can't, Stacy said. No one's allowed down there anymore except for officers on a special list. And I'm not one of them. There's a whole basket of charges, including attempted murder and accessory to murder. Take it easy coming back to town. You won't be allowed to see him, so there's no sense wrecking your shop on the way.
Linda keyed the mic 3 times. Break, break, break. Then she said,
I'll see him, all right.
But she didn't. Chief Peter Randolph, looking freshly rested from his nap, met her at the top of the PD steps and told her he'd need her badge and gun. As Rusty's wife, she was also under suspicion of undermining the lawful town government and fomenting insurrection. Fine, she wanted to tell him. Arrest me. Put me downstairs with my husband. But then she thought of the girls who would be at Marta's now, waiting to be picked up, wanting to tell her all about their day at school. She also thought of the meeting at the parsonage that night. She couldn't attend that if she was in a cell, and the meeting was now more important than ever. Because if they were going to break one prisoner out tomorrow night, why not 2?
Tell him I love him,
Linda said, unbuckling her belt and sliding the holster off it. She hadn't really cared for the weight of the gun anyway. Crossing the little ones on the way to school and telling the middle school kids to ditch both their cigarettes and their foul mouths. Those things were more her forte. I will convey that message, Mrs. Everett.
Has anyone looked at his hand? I heard from someone that his hand might be broken.
Randolph frowned. Who told you that?
I don't know who called me. He didn't identify himself. It was one of our guys, I think, but the reception out there on 117 isn't very good.
Randolph considered this, decided not to pursue it. Rusty's hand is fine, he said, and our guys aren't your guys anymore. Go on home. I'm sure we'll have questions for you later.
She felt tears and fought them back. And what am I supposed to tell my girls? Am I supposed to tell them their daddy is in jail? You know Rusty's one of the good guys, you know that. God, he was the one who diagnosed your hot gallbladder last year.
Can't help you much there, Mrs. Everett, Randolph said. His days of calling her Linda seemed to be behind him. But I suggest you don't tell them that Daddy conspired with Dale Barbara in the murder of Brenda Perkins and Lester Coggins. The others were not sure of. Those were clearly sex crimes, and Rusty may not have known about them.
That's insane.
Randolph might not have heard. He also tried to kill Selectman Rennie by withholding vital medication. Luckily, Big Jim had the foresight to conceal a couple of officers nearby. He shook his head. Threatening to withhold life-saving medication from a man who's made himself sick caring for this town. That's your good guy. That's your goddamn good guy. She was in trouble here and knew it. She left before she could make it worse. The 5 hours before the meeting at the Congo Parsonage stretched long before her. She could think of nowhere to go, nothing to do. Then she did. 11. Rusty's hand was far from fine. Even Barbie could see that. And there were three empty cells between them. Rusty, anything I can do? Rusty managed to smile.
Not unless you've got a couple of aspirin you can toss me. Darvocet would be even better.
Fresh out. They didn't give you anything?
No, but the pain's down a bit. I'll survive.
This talk was a good deal braver than he actually felt. The pain was very bad, and he was about to make it worse.
I've got to do something about these fingers, though.
Good luck. For a wonder, none of the fingers was broken, although a bone in his hand was. It was a metacarpal, the fifth. The only thing he could do about that was tear strips from his t-shirt and use them as a splint. But first, he grasped his left index finger, which was dislocated at the proximal interphalangeal joint. In the movies, this stuff always happened fast. Fast was dramatic. Unfortunately, fast could make things worse instead of better. He applied slow, steady, increasing pressure. The pain was gruesome. He felt it all the way up to the hinges of his jaw. He could hear the finger creaking like the hinge of a door that hasn't been opened in a long time. Somewhere, both close by and in another country, he glimpsed Barbie standing at the door of his cell and watching. Then, suddenly, the finger was magically straight again and the pain was less. In that one, anyway. He sat down on the bunk, gasping like a man who has just run a race. Done? Barbie asked.
Not quite. I also have to fix my fuck you finger. I may need it.
Rusty grasped his second finger and began again. And again. Just when it seemed the pain could get no worse, the dislocated joint slipped back into place. Now there was just the matter of his pinky, which was sticking out as if he meant to make a toast. And I would if I could, he thought, to the most fucked up day in history. In the history of Eric Everett, at least. He began to wrap the finger. This also hurt. And for this, there was no quick fix. What'd you do? Barbie asked, then snapped his fingers twice sharply. He pointed at the ceiling, then cupped one hand to his ear. Did he actually know the coop was bugged or only suspect it? Rusty decided it didn't matter. It would be best to behave as if it were, although it was hard to believe anyone in this fumble bunch had thought of it yet.
Made the mistake of trying to get Big Jim to step down, Rusty said. I've no doubt they'll add a dozen or so other charges, but basically I got jailed for telling him to quit pushing so hard, or he'd have a heart attack.
This, of course, ignored the Coggins stuff. But Rusty thought that might be just as well for his continued good health.
How's the food in here?
Not bad, Barbie said. Rose brought me lunch. You want to watch out for the water, though. It can be a trifle salty.
He forked the first two fingers of his right hand, pointed them at his eyes, then pointed at his own mouth. Watch. Rusty nodded. Tomorrow night, Barbie mouthed. I know, Rusty mouthed back. Making the exaggerated syllables caused his lips to crack open and start bleeding again. Barbie mouthed, we need a safe place. Thanks to Joe McClatchy and his friends, Rusty thought he had that part covered. 12. Andy Sanders had a seizure. It was inevitable, really. He was unused to glass, and he'd been smoking a lot of it. He was in the WCIK studio, listening to the Our Daily Bread Symphony soar through How Great Thou Art, and conducting along with it. He saw himself flying down eternal violin strings. Chef was somewhere with the bong, but he'd left Andy a supply of fat hybrid cigarettes he called Fry Daddies.
You want to be careful with these, Sanders, he said. They are dynamite. For thee not used to drinking must be gentle. 1 Timothy. It also applies to fries.
Andy nodded solemnly, but smoked like a demon once Chef was gone. Two of the daddies, one after the other. He puffed until they were nothing but hot nubs that burned his fingers. The roasting cat pee smell of the glass was already rising to the top of his aromatherapy hit parade. He was halfway through the third daddy, and still conducting like Leonard Bernstein, when he sucked in a particularly deep lungful and instantly blacked out. He fell to the floor and lay twitching in a river of sacred music. Spit foam oozed between his clenched teeth. His half-open eyes rolled around in their sockets, seeing things that weren't there. At least, not yet. 10 minutes later, he was awake again, and lively enough to go flying along the path between the studio and the long red supply building out back.
Chef!
He bawled.
Chef, where are you? They're coming.
Chef Bushy stepped from the supply building's side door. His hair stood up from his head in greasy quills. He was dressed in a filthy pair of pajama pants, pea-stained at the crotch and grass-stained at the bottoms. Printed with cartoon frogs saying ribbit, they hung precariously from the bony flanges of his hips, displaying a fluff of pubic hair in front and the crack of his ass in back. He had his AK-47 in one hand. On the stock he had carefully painted the words, God's Warrior. The garage door opener was in his other hand. He put God's Warrior down, but not God's door opener. He grasped Andy's shoulders and gave him a smart shake.
Stop it, Sanders, you're hysterical.
They're coming, the bitter men, just like you said.
Chef considered this.
Did someone call and give you a heads up?
No. It was a vision.
I blacked out and had a vision.
Chef's eyes widened. Suspicion gave way to respect. He looked from Andy to Little Bitch Road and then back to Andy again.
What did you see? How many? Is it all of them or just a few like before?
I...
Chef shook him again, but much more gently this time.
Calm down, Sanders. You're in the Lord's army now and...
A Christian soldier.
Right. And I'm your superior, so report.
They're coming in two trucks.
Only two?
Yes.
Orange?
Yes.
Chef hitched up his PJs. They subsided to their former position almost immediately, and nodded.
Town trucks. Probably those same three dumbwits. The Bowies and Mr. Chicken.
Mr.
Killian, Sanders, who else? He smokes the glass, but doesn't understand the purpose of the glass. He's a fool.
They're coming for more propane.
Should we hide? Just hide and let them take it?
That's what I did before. But not this time. I'm done hiding and letting people take things. Star Wormwood has blazed. It's time for men of God to hoist their flag. Are you with me?
And Andy, who under the dome had lost everything that had ever meant anything to him, did not hesitate.
Yes.
To the end, Sanders?
To the end.
Where at did you put your gun?
As best as Andy could recollect, it was in the studio, leaning against the poster of Pat Robertson with his arm around the late Lester Coggins.
Let's get it, Chef said,
picking up God's Warrior and checking the clip.
And from now on, you carry it with you. Have you got that?
Okay.
Box of ammo in there?
Yep.
Andy had toted one of these crates in just an hour ago. At least he thought it had been an hour ago. Fry Daddy's had a way of bending time at the edges. Just a minute, Chef said. He went down the side of the supply building to the box of Chinese grenades and brought back three. He gave two to Andy and told him to put them in his pockets. Chef hung the third grenade from the muzzle of God's warrior by the pull ring. Sanders, I was told that you get 7 seconds after you yank the pin to get rid of these cocksuckers. But when I tried one in the gravel pit back yonder, it was more like 4. You can't trust your Oriental races. Remember that. Andy said he would. All right, come on. Let's get your weapon. Hesitantly, Andy asked,
Are we going to take them out?
Chef looked surprised.
Not unless we have to, no.
Good,
Andy said. In spite of everything, he didn't really want to hurt anyone. But if they force the issue, we'll do what's necessary. Do you understand that?
Yes,
Andy said. Chef clapped him on the shoulder. 13. Joe asked his mother if Benny and Nori could spend the night. Claire said it was okay with her if it was okay with their parents. It would, in fact, be something of a relief. After their adventure on Black Ridge, she liked the idea of having them under her eye. They could make popcorn on the wood stove and continue the raucous game of Monopoly they'd begun an hour ago. It was too raucous, actually. Their chatter and catcalls had a nervy, whistling past the graveyard quality she didn't care for. Benny's mother agreed, and, somewhat to her surprise, so did Nori's.
Good deal, Joni Calvert said. I've been wanting to get schnockered ever since this happened. Looks like tonight's my chance. And Claire, tell that girl to hunt up her grandfather tomorrow and give him a kiss.
Who's her grandfather?
Ernie. You know Ernie, don't you? Everybody knows Ernie. He worries about her, so do I sometimes. That skateboard.
There was a shudder in Joni's voice.
I'll tell her.
Claire had no more than hung up when there was a knock at the door. At first she didn't know who the middle-aged woman with the pale, strange face was. Then she realized it was Linda Everett, who ordinarily worked the school crossing beat and ticketed cars that overstayed their welcome in the 2-hour parking zones on Main Street. And she wasn't middle-aged at all. She just looked that way now.
Linda, Claire said, what's wrong? Is it Rusty? Has something happened to Rusty?
She was thinking of radiation, at least in the front of her mind. In the back, even worse ideas slithered around.
He's been arrested.
The Monopoly game in the dining room had ceased. The participants now stood together in the living room doorway, gazing at Linda solemnly.
It's a whole laundry list of charges, including criminal complicity in the murders of Lester Coggins and Brenda Perkins.
No! Benny cried.
Claire thought of telling them to leave the room and decided it would be hopeless. She thought she knew why Linda was here and understood it, but still hated her a little for coming. And Rusty, too, for getting the kids involved. Except they were all involved, weren't they? Under the dome, involvement was no longer a matter of choice.
He got in Rennie's way, Linda said. That's what it's really about. That's what it's all about now, as far as Big Jim's concerned. Who's in his way and who isn't? He's forgotten entirely what a terrible situation we're in here. No, it's worse than that. He's using the situation.
Joe looked at Linda solemnly.
Does Mr. Rennie know where we went this morning, Ms. Everett? Does he know about the box?
I don't think he should know about the box.
What box?
The one we found on Black Ridge, Nori said. We only saw the light it puts out. Rusty went right up and looked at it. It's the generator, Benny said. Only he couldn't shut it off. He couldn't even lift it, although he said it was real small.
I don't know anything about this, Linda said.
Then neither does Rennie, Joe said. He looked as if the weight of the world had just slipped off his shoulders.
How do you know?
Because he would have sent the cops to question us, Joe said. And if we didn't answer the questions, they'd take us to jail. At a distance, there came a pair of faint reports. Claire cocked her head and frowned.
Were those firecrackers or gunshots?
Linda didn't know, and because they hadn't come from town, they were too faint for that.
She didn't care.
Kids, tell me what happened on Black Ridge. Tell me everything. What you saw and what Rusty saw. And later tonight there's some other people you may have to tell. It's time we put together everything we know. In fact, it's past time.
Claire opened her mouth to say she didn't want to get involved, then didn't. Because there was no choice. None, at least, that she could see. 14. The WCIK studio was set well back from Little Bitch Road, and the driveway leading to it, paved and in far better shape than the road itself, was almost a quarter of a mile long. At the Little Bitch end, it was flanked by a pair of 100-year oaks. Their fall foliage, in a normal season brilliant enough to qualify for a calendar or tourism brochure, now hung limp and brown. Andy Sanders stood behind one of these crenellated trunks. Chef was behind the other. They could hear the approaching diesel roar of big trucks. Sweat ran into Andy's eyes and he wiped it away.
Sanders.
What?
Is your safety off?
Andy checked.
Yes.
All right. Listen, and get it right the first time. If I tell you to start shooting, spray those motherfuckers. Top to bottom, fore and aft. If I don't tell you to shoot, just stand there. Have you got that?
Yes.
I don't think there's going to be any killing.
Thank God, Andy thought.
Not if it's just the Bowies and Mr. Chicken, but I can't be sure. If I do have to make a play, will you back me?
Yes. No hesitation.
And keep your finger off that damn trigger or you're apt to blow your own head off.
Andy looked down, saw his finger was indeed curled around the trigger of the AK, and removed it in a hurry. They waited. Andy could hear his heartbeat in the middle of his head. He told himself it was stupid to be afraid. If not for a fortuitous phone call, he'd already be dead. But it did no good, because a new world had opened in front of him. He knew it might turn out to be a false world. Hadn't he seen what dope had done to Andy Grinnell? But it was better than the shitty world he'd been living in.
God, please let them just go away, he prayed. Please.
The trucks appeared, rolling slow and blowing dark smoke into the muted remains of the day. Peeking from behind his tree, Andy could see two men in the lead truck. Probably the Bowies. For a long time, Chef didn't move. Andy was beginning to think he'd changed his mind and meant to let them take the propane after all. Then Chef stepped out and triggered off two quick rounds. Stoned or not, Chef's aim was good. Both front tires of the lead truck went flat. The front end pogoed up and down three or four times, and then the truck came to a halt. The one behind almost rear-ended it. Andy could hear the faint sound of music, some hymn, and guessed that whoever was driving the second truck hadn't heard the gunshots over the radio. The cab of the lead truck, meanwhile, looked empty. Both men had ducked down out of sight. Chef Bushy, still barefooted and wearing nothing but his rivet PJs, the garage door opener was hooked over the sagging waistband like a beeper, stepped out from behind his tree.
"Stuart Bowie," he called. "Fern Bowie, come on out of there and talk to me."
He leaned God's warrior against the oak. Nothing from the cab of the lead truck, but the driver's door of the second truck opened and Roger Killian got out.
"What's the holdup?" he bawled. "I gotta get back and feed my chick."
Then he saw Chef.
"Hey there, Philly, what's up?"
"Get down," one of the Bowies bawled. "Crazy son of a bitch is shooting."
Roger looked at Chef, then at the AK-47 leaning against the tree.
"Maybe he was, but he's put the gun down. Besides, it's just him. What's the deal, Phil?"
"I'm Chef now. Call me Chef."
"Okay, Chef, what's the deal?"
"Come on out, Stuart," Chef called. "You too, Fern. Nobody's gonna get hurt here, I guess."
The doors of the lead truck opened. Without turning his head, Chef said,
"Sanders, if either of those two fools has a gun, you open up. Never mind single shot. Turn him into taco cheese."
But neither Bowie had a gun. Fern had his hands hoisted.
"Who are you talking to, buddy?" Stuart asked.
"Step out here, Sanders," Chef said.
Andy did. Now that the threat of immediate carnage seemed to have passed, he was starting to enjoy himself.
If he'd thought to bring one of Chef's Fry Daddies with him, he was sure he'd be enjoying himself even more.
"Andy," Stuart said, astounded, "what are you doing here?"
"I've been drafted into the Lord's army, and you are bitter men. We know all about you, and you have no place here."
"Huh?" Fern said.
He lowered his hands. The nose of the lead truck was slowly canting toward the road as the big front tires continued to deflate.
"Well said, Sanders,"
Chef told him. Then to Stuart.
"All three of you get in that second truck, turn it around and haul your sorry asses back to town. When you get there, tell that apostate son of the devil that WCIK is ours now. That includes the lab and all the supplies."
"What the fuck are you talking about, Phil?"
"Chef."
Stuart made a flapping gesture with one hand.
"Call yourself whatever you want. Just tell me, what is this about?"
"I know your brother's stupid," Chef said, "and Mr. Chicken there probably can't tie his own shoes without a blueprint."
"Hey," Roger cried. "Watch your mouth."
Andy raised his AK. He thought that when he got a chance, he would paint Claudette on the stock.
"No, you watch yours."
Roger Killian went pale and fell back a step. That had never happened when Andy spoke at a town meeting, and it was very gratifying. Chef went on talking as if there had been no interruption.
"But you've got at least half a brain, Stuart, so use it. Leave that truck setting right where it is and go back to town and tell the one. Tell Rennie this out here doesn't belong to him anymore. It belongs to God. Tell him Star Wormwood has blazed, and if he doesn't want the apocalypse to come early, he better leave us alone."
He considered.
"You can also tell him we'll keep putting out the music. I doubt he's worried about that, but there's some in town might find it a comfort."
"Do you know how many cops he's got now?"
Stuart asked.
"I don't give a tin shit.
I think about 30. But tomorrow it's apt to be 50, and half the damn town's wearing blue support armbands. If he tells them to posse up, it won't be no trouble."
"It won't be no help either," Chef said. "Our faith is in the Lord, and our strength is that of 10.
"Well," Roger said, flashing his math skills, "that's 20, but you're still outnumbered."
"Shut up, Roger," Fern said.
Stuart tried again.
"Phil, Chef, I mean, you need to chill the fuck out. Because this ain't no thang. He don't want the dope, just the propane. Half the Jennies in town are out. By the weekend, it'll be 3/4. Let us take the propane."
"I need it to cook with. Sorry."
Stuart looked at him as if he had gone mad. "He probably has," Andy thought. "We probably both have." But of course, Jim Rennie was mad too, so that was a wash.
"Go on now," Chef said, "and tell him that if he tries sending troops against us, he will regret it."
Stuart thought this over, then shrugged.
"No skin off my rosy red chinchina. Come on, Fern. Roger, I'll drive."
"Fine by me," Roger Killian said. "I hate all them gears."
He gave Chef and Andy a final look rich with mistrust, then started back to the second truck.
"God bless you, fellas," Andy called.
Stuart threw a sour dart of a glance back over his shoulder.
"God bless you, too, because God knows you're going to need it."
The new proprietors of the largest meth lab in North America stood side by side, watching the big orange truck back down the road, make a clumsy K-turn, and drive away.
"Sanders?"
"Yes, Chef?"
"I want to pep up the music, and immediately. This town needs some Mavis Staples. Also some Clark Sisters. Once I get that shit queued up, let's smoke."
Andy's eyes filled with tears. He put his arm around the former Phil Bushy's bony shoulders and hugged.
"I love you, Chef."
"Thanks, Sanders. Right back at you. Just keep your gun loaded. From now on, we'll have to stand watches."
15. Big Jim was sitting at his son's bedside as approaching sunset turned the day orange. Douglas Twitchell had come in to give Junior a shot. Now the boy was deeply asleep. In some ways, Big Jim knew, it would be better if Junior died. Alive and with a tumor pressing down on his brain, there was no telling what he might do or say. Of course, the kid was his own flesh and blood, but there was the greater good to think about. The good of the town. One of the extra pillows in the closet would probably do it. That was when his phone rang. He looked at the name in the window and frowned. Something had gone wrong. Stuart would hardly be calling so soon if it were otherwise. What? He listened with growing astonishment. Andy? Out there? Andy with a gun? Stuart was waiting for him to answer, waiting to be told what to do. Get in line, pal, Big Jim thought, and sighed.
Give me a minute, I need to think.
I'll call you back. He ended the call and considered this new problem. He could take a bunch of cops out there tonight. In some ways, it was an attractive idea. Whip them up at Food City, then lead the raid himself. If Andy died, so much the better. That would make James Rennie Sr. the entire town government. On the other hand, the special town meeting was tomorrow night. Everyone would come, and there would be questions. He was sure he could lay the meth lab off on Barbara and the friends of Barbara. In Big Jim's mind, Andy Sanders had now become an official friend of Barbara. But still, no. No. He wanted his flock scared, but not in an outright panic. Panic wouldn't serve his purpose, which was to establish complete control of the town. And if he let Andy and Bushy stay where they were for a little while, what harm? It might even do some good. They'd grow complacent. They might fancy themselves forgotten, because drugs were full of vitamin stupid. Friday, on the other hand, the day after tomorrow, was that cotton picker Cox's designated visitor's day. Everybody would stream out to the Dinsmore farm again. Burpee would no doubt set up another hot dog stand. While that cluster mug was going on, and while Cox was conducting his one-man press conference, Big Jim himself could lead a force of 16 or 18 police up to the radio station and wipe those two troublesome stoners out. Yes. That was the answer. He called Stuart back and told him to leave well enough alone. "But I thought you wanted the propane," Stuart said.
"We'll get it," Big Jim said. "And you can help us take care of those two, if you want to."
"You're damn right I want to. That son of a bitch... Sorry, Big Jim. That son of a buck Bushy needs a payback."
"He'll get it. Friday afternoon. Clear his schedule."
Big Jim felt fine again. Heart beating slowly and steadily in his chest. Nary a stutter or flutter. And that was good, because there was so much to do, starting with tonight's police pep talk at Food City. Just the right environment in which to impress the importance of order on a bunch of new cops. Really, there was nothing like a scene of destruction to get people playing follow the leader. He started out of the room, then went back and kissed his sleeping son's cheek. Getting rid of Junior might become necessary, but for the time being, that too could wait. 16. Another night is falling on the little town of Chester's Mill. Another night under the dome. But there is no rest for us. We have two meetings to attend, and we also ought to check up on Horace the Corgi before we sleep. Horace is keeping Andrea Grinnell company tonight, and although he is for the moment biding his time, he has not forgotten the popcorn between the couch and the wall. So let us go then, you and I, while the evening spreads out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go while the first discolored stars begin to show overhead. This is the only town in a four-state area where they're out tonight. Rain has overspread northern New England, and cable news viewers will soon be treated to some remarkable satellite photographs showing a hole in the clouds that exactly mimics the sock shape of Chester's Mill. Here the stars shine down, but now they're dirty stars, because the dome is dirty. Heavy showers fall in Tarker's Mills, and the part of Castle Rock known as The View. CNN's meteorologist, Reynolds Wolfe, no relation to Rose Twitchell's Wolfie, says that while no one can as yet be entirely sure, it seems likely that the west-to-east airflow is pushing the clouds against the western side of the dome and squeezing them like sponges before they can slide away to the north and south. He calls it a fascinating phenomenon. Suzanne Melvaux, the anchor, asks him what the long-term weather under the dome might be like if the crisis continues. "Suzanne," Reynolds Wolfe says, "that's a great question. All we know for sure is that Chester's Mill isn't getting any rain tonight, although the surface of the dome is permeable enough so that some moisture may be seeping through where the showers are heaviest. NOAA meteorologists tell me the long-term prospects of precip under the dome aren't good. And we know their principal waterway, Presteel Stream, has pretty much dried up. He smiles, showing a great set of TV teeth. Thank God for artesian wells.
You bet, Reynolds, Suzanne says.
And then the Geico Gecko appears on the TV screens of America. That's enough cable news. Let us float through certain half-deserted streets, past the Congo Church and the parsonage. The meeting there hasn't started yet, but Piper has loaded up the big coffee urn, and Julia is making sandwiches by the light of a hissing Coleman lamp. Past the McCain house surrounded by its sad sag of yellow police tape. Downtown Common Hill and past the town hall, where Janitor Al Timmons and a couple of his friends are cleaning and sprucing up for the special town meeting tomorrow night. Past War Memorial Plaza, where the statue of Lucian Calvert, Nori's great-grandfather, I probably don't have to tell you that, keeps his long watch. We'll stop for a quick check on Barbie and Rusty, shall we? There'll be no problem getting downstairs. There are only three cops in the ready room, and Stacy Moggin, who's on the desk, is sleeping with her head pillowed on her forearm. The rest of the PD is at Food City, listening to Big Jim's latest stem winder, but it wouldn't matter if they were all here, because we are invisible. They would feel no more than a faint draft as we glide past them. There's not much to see in the coop, because Hope is as invisible as we are. The two men have nothing to do but wait until tomorrow night, and hope that things break their way. Rusty's hand hurts, but the pain isn't as bad as he thought it might be, and the swelling isn't as bad as he feared. Also, Stacy Moggin, God bless her heart, snuck him a couple of Excedrin around 5 p.m. For the time being, these two men, our heroes, I suppose, are sitting on their bunks and playing 20 questions. It's Rusty's turn to guess.
Animal, vegetable, or mineral? He asks.
None of them, Barbie replies.
How can it be none of them? It has to be one.
It's not, Barbie says. He is thinking of Papa Smurf.
You're jacking me up.
I'm not.
You have to be.
Quit bitching and start asking.
Can I have a hint?
No, that's your first no, 19 to go.
Wait a goddamn minute, that's not fair.
We'll leave them to shift the weight of the next 24 hours as best they can, shall we? Let us make our way past the still-simmering heap of ashes that used to be the Democrat. Alas, no longer serving the little town that looks like a boot. Past Sanders' hometown drug, scorched but still standing, although Andy Sanders will never pass through its doors again. Past the bookstore and Leclerc's Maison des Fleurs, where all the fleurs are now dead or dying. Let us pass under the dead stoplight marking the intersection of routes 119 and 117. We brush it. It sways slightly. Then stills again. And cross the Food City parking lot. We are as silent as a child's sleeping breath. The supermarket's big front windows have been covered with plywood requisitioned from Tabby Morrell's lumberyard. And the worst of the gluck on the floor has been mopped up by Jack Cale and Ernie Calvert. But Food City is still a god-awful mess, with boxes and dry goods strewn from hell to breakfast. The remaining merchandise, what hasn't been carted away to various town pantries or stored in the motor pool behind the PD, in other words, is scattered helter-skelter on the shelves. The soft drink cooler, beer cooler, and ice cream freezer are busted in. There's the high stink of spilled wine. This leftover chaos is exactly what Big Jim Rennie wants his new, and awfully young for the most part, cadre of enforcement officers to see. He wants them to realize the whole town could look like this. And he's canny enough to know he doesn't need to say it right out loud. They will get the point. This is what happens when the shepherd fails in his duty and the flock stampedes. Do we need to listen to his speech? Nah. We'll be listening to Big Jim tomorrow night, and that should be enough. Besides, we all know how this one goes. America's two great specialties are demagogues and rock and roll, and we've all heard plenty of both in our time. Yet, we should examine the faces of his listeners before we go. Notice how rapt they are. And then remind yourself that many of these, Carter Thibodeau, Mickey Wardlaw, and Todd Wendell Statt, to name just three, are chumps who couldn't get through a single week of school without scoring detention for causing trouble in class or fighting in the bathrooms. But Rennie has them hypnotized. He's never been much of a shake one-on-one, but when he's in front of a crowd, rowdy-dow and hot-cha-cha, as old Clayton Brassy used to say back in the days when he still had a few working brain cells. Big Jim's telling them, thin blue line, and the pride of standing with your fellow officers, and the town is depending on you. Other stuff, too.
The good stuff that never loses its charm. Big Jim switches to Barbie. He tells him that Barbie's friends are still out there, sowing discord and fomenting dissension for their own evil purposes. Lowering his voice, he says, "They'll try to discredit me. The lies they'll tell have no bottom." A growl of displeasure greets this. "Will you listen to lies? Will you let them discredit me? Will you allow this town to go without a strong leader in its time of greatest need?" The answer, of course, is a resounding no. And although Big Jim continues, like most politicians, he believes in not just gilding the lily but spray painting it, we can leave him now. Let's head up these deserted streets to the Congo parsonage. And look, here's someone we can walk with. A 13-year-old girl dressed in faded jeans and an old-school winged ripper skateboard tee. The tough riot girl pout that is her mother's despair is gone from Nori Calvert's face this evening. It has been replaced by an expression of wonder that makes her look like the 8-year-old she not so long ago was. We follow her gaze and see a vast full moon climbing from the clouds to the east of town. It is the color and shape of a freshly cut pink grapefruit.
"Oh, my God,"
Nori whispers. One fisted hand is pressed between the scant nubs of her breasts as she looks at that pink freak of a moon. Then she walks on, not so amazed that she fails to look around herself from time to time to make sure she's not being noticed. This is as per Linda Everett's order. They were to go alone, they were to be unobtrusive, and they were to make absolutely sure they weren't followed. "This isn't a game," Linda told them. Nori was more impressed by her pale, strained face than by her words. "If we get caught, they won't just take away hit points or make us miss a turn. Do you kids understand that?" "Can I go with Joe?" Mrs. McClatchy asked. She was almost as pale as Mrs. Everett. Mrs. Everett shook her head. "Bad idea." And that had impressed Nori most of all. No, not a game. Maybe life and death. Ah, but there is the church. And the parsonage, tucked in right beside it. Nori can see the bright white light of Coleman lanterns around back, where the kitchen must be. Soon she'll be inside, out from under the gaze of that awful pink moon. Soon she'll be safe. So she's thinking when a shadow detaches itself from one of the thicker shadows and takes her by the arm. 17. Nori was too startled to scream, which was just as well. When the pink moon lit the face of the man who had accosted her, she saw it was Romeo Burpee.
"You scared the crap out of me," she whispered.
"Sorry, just keeping an eye out, me."
Romy let go of her arm and looked around.
"Where are your boyfriends?"
Nori smiled at that.
"Dunno. We were supposed to come by ourselves in different ways. That's what Mrs. Everett said."
She looked down the hill.
"I think that's Joey's mom coming now. We should go in."
They walked toward the light of the lanterns. The parsonage's inner door was standing open. Romy knocked softly on the side of the screen and said,
"Romy Burpee and a friend. If there's a password, we didn't get it."
Piper Libby opened the door and let them in. She looked curiously at Nori.
"Who are you?"
"Damn if that isn't my granddaughter,"
Ernie said, coming into the room. He had a glass of lemonade in one hand and a grin on his face.
"Come here, girl, I've been missing you."
Nori gave him a strong hug and kissed him as her mother had instructed. She hadn't expected to obey those instructions so soon, but was glad to do so. And to him, she could tell the truth that torture would not have dragged from her lips in front of the guy she hung with.
"Grandpa, I'm so scared."
"We all are, honey girl."
He hugged her more tightly, then looked into her upturned face.
"I don't know what you're doing here, but now that you are, how about a glass of lemonade?"
Nori saw the urn and said,
"I'd rather have coffee."
"So would I," Piper said. "I got it all loaded with high test and ready to go before I remembered I have no power."
She gave her head a little shake as if to clear it.
"This keeps hitting me in different ways."
There was another knock at the back door, and Lissa Jameson came in, her cheeks high with color.
"I stashed my bike in your garage, Reverend Libby. I hope that's okay."
"Fine. And if we're engaging in criminal conspiracy here, as Rennie and Randolph would no doubt contend, you better call me Piper.
18. They were all early, and Piper called the Chester's Mill Revolutionary Committee to order at just past 9 o'clock. What impressed her initially was how uneven the sexual division was. 8 females, and only 4 males. And of the 4 males, 1 was past retirement age, and 2 weren't old enough to get into an R-rated movie by themselves. She had to remind herself that 100 guerrilla armies in various parts of the world had put guns in the hands of women and kids no older than these here tonight. That didn't make it right, but sometimes what was right and what was necessary came into conflict.
"I'd like us to bow our heads for a minute," Piper said. "I'm not going to pray because I'm no longer sure just who I'm talking to when I do that. But you might want to say a word to the God of your understanding, because tonight we need all the help we can get."
They did as she asked. Some still had their heads down and their eyes closed when Piper raised her own head to look at them. 2 recently fired lady cops, a retired supermarket manager, a newspaper woman who no longer had a newspaper, a librarian, the owner of the local restaurant, a dome widow who couldn't stop spinning the wedding ring on her finger, the local department store tycoon, and 3 uncharacteristically solemn-faced kids sitting scrunched together on the sofa.
"Okay. Amen," Piper said. "I'm going to turn the meeting over to Jackie Weddington, who knows what she's doing."
"That's probably too optimistic," Jackie said. "Not to mention hasty, because I'm going to turn the meeting over to Joe McClatchy."
Joe looked startled.
"Me?"
"But before he gets going," she went on, "I'm going to ask his friends to serve as lookouts, Nori in front and Benny in back." Jackie saw the protest on their faces and raised a hand to forestall it. "This isn't an excuse to get you out of the room. It's important. I don't need to tell you it might not be good if the powers that be caught us in conclave. You 2 are the smallest. Find some nice deep shadows and slide in. If you see someone coming who looks suspicious or any of the town police cars, clap your hands, like this." She clapped once, then twice, then once more. "You'll be filled in on everything later, I promise you. The new order of the day is pooled information, no secrets." When they were gone, Jackie turned to Joe. "This box you told Linda about, tell everyone. From beginning to end." Joe did it on his feet, as if reciting in school.
"Then we came back to town," he finished, "and that bastard Rennie had Rusty arrested."
He wiped sweat from his forehead and sank back down on the couch. Claire put an arm around his shoulders. "Joe says it would be bad for Rennie to find out about the box," she said. "He thinks Rennie might want it to keep on doing what it's doing, instead of trying to turn it off or destroy it."
"I think he's right," Jackie said. "So its existence and location is our first secret."
"I don't know," Joe said.
"What?" Julia asked. "You think he should know?"
"Maybe. Sort of. I need to think."
Jackie pushed on without questioning him further.
"Here's the second order of business. I want to try and break Barbie and Rusty out of jail. Tomorrow night, during the big town meeting. Barbie's the guy the president designated to take over the town administration."
"Anybody but Rennie," Ernie growled. "Incompetent son of a bitch thinks he owns this burg."
"He's good at one thing," Linda said, "stirring up trouble when it suits him. The food riot and the newspaper being burned, I think both of those were done according to his orders."
"Of course they were," Jackie said. "Anyone who could kill his own pastor." Rose goggled at her.
"Are you saying Rennie killed Coggins?"
Jackie told him about the basement workroom in the funeral parlor, and how the marks on Coggins' face matched the gold baseball Rusty had seen in Rennie's study. They listened with dismay, but no disbelief.
"The girls, too?"
Lissa Jameson said in a small, horrified voice.
"I've got his son down for that."
Jackie spoke almost briskly. "And those murders were probably not related to Big Jim's political machinations. Junior collapsed this morning. At the McCain house, incidentally, where the bodies were found. By him."
"What a coincidence," Ernie said.
"He's in the hospital. Jenny Tomlinson says it's almost certainly a brain tumor, which can cause violent behavior."
A father-son murder team.
Claire was hugging Joe more tightly than ever. Not a team, exactly, Jackie said. Call it the same wild strain of behavior, something genetic, coming out under pressure. Linda said, but the bodies being in the same place strongly suggests that if there were two murderers, they were working together. The point is, my husband and Dale Barbara are almost certainly being held by a killer who's using them to build a grand conspiracy theory. The only reason they haven't already been killed in custody is because Rennie wants to make an example of them. He wants them executed in public. Her face cramped for a moment as she fought off tears.
I can't believe he's gotten as far as he has, Alyssa said.
She was twisting the ankh she wore back and forth.
He's a used car dealer, for heaven's sake.
Silence greeted this. Now look, Jackie said after it had stretched out a bit. By telling you what Linda and I mean to do, I've made this a real conspiracy. I'm going to ask for a vote. If you want to be a part of this, raise your hand. Those who don't raise their hands can leave, contingent on a promise not to blab about what we've discussed, which you wouldn't want to do anyway. If you don't tell anybody who was here and what was discussed, you won't have to explain how you heard. This is dangerous. We might end up in jail or even worse. So let's see some hands. Who wants to stay? Joe raised his hand first. But Piper, Julia, Rose, and Ernie Calvert were not far behind. Linda and Romy raised their hands together. Lissa looked at Claire McClatchy. Claire sighed and nodded. The two women raised their hands.
Way to go, Mom, Joe said.
If you ever tell your father what I let you get into, she said, you won't need James Rennie to execute you. I'll do it myself. 19.
Linda can't go into the PD after them, Romy said.
He was speaking to Jackie.
Who then?
You and me, hon. Linda's gonna go to the big meeting, where 600 or 800 people can testify that they saw her.
Why can't I go? Linda asked. That's my husband they've got.
That's why, Julia said simply.
How do you want to do it? Romy asked Jackie.
Well, I suggest we wear masks.
Duh, Rose said, and made a face. They all laughed.
Lucky us, Romy said. I got a great selection of Halloween masks at the store.
Maybe I'll be the Little Mermaid, Jackie said a little wistfully.
She realized everyone was looking at her and blushed. Whatever. In any case, we'll need guns. I have an extra at home, a Beretta. Do you have something, Romy?
I put away some rifles and shotguns in the store safe and got at least one with a scope. I won't say I saw this coming, but I saw something coming.
Joe spoke up.
You'll also need a getaway vehicle and not your van, Romy, because everyone knows it.
I got an idea about that, Ernie said. Let's take a vehicle from Jim Rennie's used car lot. He's got half a dozen high-mileage phone company vans he picked up last spring. They're out in the back. Using one of his would be, what do you call it, poetic justice.
And exactly how are you going to get the key? Romy asked. Break into his office at the showroom?
If the one we pick doesn't have an electronic ignition, I can hotwire it, Ernie said. Fixing Joe with a frowning glance, he added, I'd prefer you didn't tell my granddaughter that, young man.
Joe did a lip-zipping pantomime that made them all laugh again.
The special town meeting is scheduled to start at 7 tomorrow night, Jackie said. If we go into the PD around 8.
We can do better than that, Linda said. If I have to go to the damn meeting, I might as well do some good. I'll wear a dress with big pockets and carry my police radio, the extra that's still in my personal vehicle. You two, be in the van, ready to go.
Tension was creeping into the room. They all felt it. This was starting to be real.
At the loading dock behind my store, Romy said, out of sight.
Once Rennie really gets going on his speech, Linda said, I'll give you a triple break on the radio. That's your signal to roll.
How many police will there be at the station? Lissa asked.
I might be able to find out from Stacy Moggin, Jackie said. There won't be many, though. Why would there be? So far as Big Jim knows, there are no real friends of Barbie. Just the straw men he's set up.
He'll also want to make sure his tender ass is well protected, Julia said. There was some laughter at this, but Joe's mother looked deeply troubled.
There'll be some at the police station, no matter what. What are you going to do if they resist you?
They won't, Jackie said. We'll have them locked in their own cells before they know what's happening.
But if they do,
then we'll try not to kill them. Linda's voice was calm, but her eyes were those of a creature who has screwed its courage up in some final desperate effort to save itself. There's probably going to be killing anyway, if the dome stays up much longer. The execution of Barbie and my husband in War Memorial Plaza will only be the start of it.
Let's say you get them out, Julia said. Where will you take them, here?
No way, Piper said and touched her still swollen mouth. I'm already on Rennie's shit list, not to mention that guy who's now his personal bodyguard, Thibodeau. My dog bit him.
Anyway, near the center of town's not a great idea, Rose said. They could do a house-to-house. God knows they've got enough cops.
Plus all the people wearing the blue armbands, Romy added.
What about one of the summer cabins out at Chester Pond? Julia asked.
Possible, Ernie said, but they could think of that, too.
It still might be the best bet, Lissa said.
Mr. Burpee, Joe asked, have you got any more of that lead roll?
Sure, tons. And make it roomy.
If Mr. Calvert can steal a van tomorrow, could you sneak it behind your store and put a bunch of pre-cut pieces of lead roll in the back? One's big enough to cover the windows.
I guess so.
Joe looked at Jackie. And could you get hold of this Colonel Cox if you had to?
Yes.
Jackie and Julia answered together, then looked at each other in surprise. Light was dawning on Romy's face.
You're thinking about the old McCoy place, aren't you? Up on Black Ridge, where the box is.
Yeah, it might be a bad idea, but if we all had to run, if we were all up there, we could defend the box. I know that sounds crazy, since it's the thing causing all the problems, but we can't let Rennie get it.
I hope it don't come to refighting the Alamo in an apple orchard, Romy said, but I see your point.
There's something else we could do, too, Joe said. It's a little risky, and it might not work, but...
Spill it, Julia said.
She was looking at Joe McClatchy with a kind of bemused awe.
Well, is the Geiger counter still in your van, Romy?
I think so, yeah.
Maybe someone could put it back in the fallout shelter where it came from. Joe turned to Jackie and Linda. Could either of you get in there? I mean, I know you got fired.
Al Timmons would let us in, I think, Linda said, and he'd let Stacy Morgan in for sure. She's with us. The only reason she's not here right now is because she's got the duty. Why risk it, Joe?
Because... He was speaking with uncharacteristic slowness, feeling his way.
Well, there's radiation out there, see?
Bad radiation. It's just a belt. I bet you could drive right through it without any protection at all and not get hurt, if you drove fast and didn't try it too often. But they don't know that. The problem is they don't know there's radiation out there at all, and they won't, if they don't have the Geiger counter.
Jackie was frowning.
It's a cool idea, kiddo, but I don't like the idea of pointing Rennie right at where we're going. That doesn't fit with my idea of a safe house.
It wouldn't have to be like that, Joe said.
He was still speaking slowly, testing for weak spots.
Not exactly, anyway. One of you could get in touch with Cox, see? Tell him to call Rennie and say they're picking up spot radiation. Cox can say something like, can't exactly pinpoint it because it comes and goes, but it's pretty high, maybe even lethal, so watch out. You don't happen to have a Geiger counter, do you?
There was a long silence as they considered this. Then Romy said,
we take Barbara and Rusty out to the McCoy farm. We go there ourselves if we have to, which we probably will. And if they try to go out there, they get a radiation spike on the Geiger counter that sends them running back to town with their hands over their worthless gonads, Ernie rasped. Claire McClatchy, you got a genius there.
Claire hugged Joe tight, this time with both arms.
Now, if I could only get him to pick up his room, she said.
20. Horace lay on the rug in Andrea Grinnell's living room with his snout on one paw and his eye on the woman his mistress had left him with. Ordinarily, Julia took him everywhere.
He was quiet and never caused trouble, even if there were cats, which he didn't care for because of their stinkweed smell. Tonight, however, it had occurred to Julia that seeing Horace alive when her own dog was dead might cause Piper Libby pain. She had also noticed that Andy liked Horace and thought that the corgi might take Andy's mind off her withdrawal symptoms, which had abated, but not disappeared. For a while it worked. Andy found a rubber ball in the toy box she still kept for her one grandchild, who was now well past the toy box stage of life. Horace chased the ball obediently and brought it back as was required. Although there wasn't much challenge in it, he preferred balls that could be caught on the fly. But a job was a job, and he continued until Andy started shivering as if she were cold.
Oh. Oh, fuck. Here it comes again.
She lay down on the couch, shaking all over. She clutched one of the sofa pillows against her chest and stared at the ceiling. Pretty soon her teeth started to clatter, a very annoying sound in Horace's opinion. He brought her the ball, hoping to distract her, but she pushed him away.
No, honey, not now. Let me get through this.
Horace took the ball back in front of the blank TV and lay down. The woman's shaking moderated, and the sick smell moderated along with it. The arms clutching the pillow loosened, as she first began to drift, and then to snore, which meant it was chow time. Horace slipped under the table again, walking over the manila envelope containing the Vader file. Beyond it was popcorn nirvana. Oh, lucky dog. Horace was still snarking, his tailless rear end wagging with pleasure that was close to ecstasy. The scattered kernels were incredibly buttery, incredibly salty, and best of all, aged to perfection. When the dead voice spoke again,
"Take that to her."
But he couldn't. His mistress was gone.
"The other her."
The dead voice broke no refusal, and the popcorn was almost gone anyway. Horace marked a few remaining blossoms for later attention, then backed up until the envelope was in front of him. For a moment he forgot what he was supposed to do. Then he remembered and picked it up in his mouth.
"Good dog."
21. Something cold licked Andrea's cheek. She pushed it away and turned on her side. For a moment or two, she almost escaped back into healing sleep. And then there was a bark.
"Shut up, Horace."
She put the sofa pillow over her head. There was another bark, and then 34 pounds of corgi landed on her legs.
"Ah!"
Andy cried, sitting up. She looked into a pair of brilliant hazel eyes and a foxy, grinning face. Only there was something interrupting that grin, a brown manila envelope. Horace dropped it on her stomach and jumped back down. He wasn't supposed to get on furniture other than his own, but the dead voice had made this seem like an emergency. Andrea picked up the envelope, which had been dented by the points of Horace's teeth and was faintly marked with the tracks of his paws. There was also a kernel of popcorn stuck to it, which she brushed away. Whatever was inside felt fairly bulky. Printed on the front of the envelope in block letters were the words, "Vader file." Below that, also printed, "Julia Shumway."
"Horace, where did you get this?"
Horace couldn't answer that, of course, but he didn't have to. The kernel of popcorn told her where. A memory surfaced then, one so shimmery and unreal that it was more like a dream. Was it a dream, or had Brenda Perkins really come to her door after that first terrible night of withdrawal, while the food riot was going on at the other end of town?
"Will you hold this for me, dear, just for a little while? I have an errand to run, and I don't want to take it with me."
"She was here," she told Horace. "And she had this envelope. I took it. At least I think I did. But then I had to throw up. Throw up again. I might have tossed it at the table. I was running for the John." "Did it fall off? Did you find it on the floor?"
Horace uttered one sharp bark. It could have been agreement. It could have been, "I'm ready for more ball if you are."
"Well, thanks," Andrea said. "Good pup. I'll give it to Julia as soon as she comes back."
She no longer felt sleepy, and she wasn't for the moment shivery either. What she was curious. Because Brenda was dead. Murdered. And it must have happened not long after she delivered this envelope. Which might make it important.
"I'll just have a tiny peek, shall I?" she said.
Horace barked again. To Andy Grinnell, it sounded like, why not? Andrea opened the envelope, and most of Big Jim Rennie's secrets fell out into her lap. 22. Claire got home first. Benny came next, then Nori. The three of them were sitting together on the porch of the McClatchy house when Joe arrived, cutting across lawns and keeping to the shadows. Benny and Nori were drinking warm Dr. Brown's cream soda. Claire was nursing a bottle of her husband's beer as she rocked slowly to and fro on the porch glider. Joe sat down beside her, and Claire put an arm around his bony shoulders. He's fragile, she thought. He doesn't know it, but he is. No more to him than a bird.
Dude, Benny said, handing him the soda he'd saved for him. We were starting to get a little worried.
Miss Shumway had a few more questions about the box, Joe said. More than I can answer, really. Gosh, it's warm out, isn't it? Warm as a summer night. He turned his gaze upward.
And look at that moon.
I don't want to, Nori said. It's scary. You okay, honey? Claire asked.
Yeah, Mom, you? She smiled.
I don't know. Is this going to work? What do you guys think? I mean, really think.
For a moment, none of them answered, and that scared her more than anything. Then Joe kissed her on the cheek and said,
It'll work.
You're sure?
Yeah.
She could always tell when he was lying, although she knew the talent might leave her when he was older. But she didn't call him on it this time. She just kissed him back, her breath warm and somehow fatherly with beer.
Just as long as there's no bloodshed.
No blood, Joe said. She smiled.
Okay, that's good enough for me.
They sat there in the dark a while longer, saying little. Then they went inside, leaving the town to sleep under the pink moon. It was just past midnight. Blood everywhere. 1. It was 12:30 on the morning of October 26th when Julia let herself into Andrea's house. She did it quietly, but there was no need. She could hear music from Andy's little portable radio, the Staple Singers, kicking holy ass with Get Right Church. Horace came down the hall to greet her, wagging his rear end and grinning that slightly mad grin of which only corgis seem capable. He bowed before her, paws splayed, and Julia gave him a brief scratch behind the ears. It was his sweet spot. Andrea was sitting on the couch, drinking a glass of tea.
Sorry about the music, she said, turning it down. I couldn't sleep.
It's your house, honey, Julia said, and for WCIK, that really rocks. Andy smiled. It's been up-tempo gospel ever since this afternoon. I feel like I hit the jackpot. How was your meeting?
Good.
Julia sat down.
Want to talk about it?
You don't need the worry. What you need is to concentrate on feeling better. And you know what? You look a little better. It was true. Andy was still pale and much too thin, but the dark circles under her eyes had faded a little, and the eyes themselves had a new spark.
Thanks for saying so.
Was Horace a good boy?
Very good. We played ball, and then we both slept a little.
If I look better, that's probably why. Nothing like a nap to improve a girl's looks. What about your back? Andrea smiled. It was an oddly knowing smile, without much humor in it.
My back isn't bad at all. Hardly a twinge, even when I bend over.
Do you know what I think? Julia shook her head.
I think that when it comes to drugs, the body and the mind are co-conspirators. If the brain wants drugs, the body helps out. It says, don't worry, don't feel guilty, it's okay, I really hurt. It's not exactly hypochondria I'm talking about, nothing so simple, just...
She trailed off and her eyes grew distant as she went somewhere else.
Where?
Julia wondered. Then she came back.
Human nature can be destructive. Tell me, do you think a town is like a body?
Yes, Julia said instantly.
And can it say it hurts, so the brain can take the drugs it craves?
Julia considered, then nodded.
Yes. And right now, Big Jim Rennie is this town's brain, isn't he?
Yes, hon. I'd say he is. Andrea sat on the couch, head slightly lowered. Then she snapped off the little battery radio and got to her feet.
I think I'll go up to bed. And do you know, I think I might actually be able to sleep.
That's good. And then for no reason she could have articulated, Julia asked, Andy, did anything happen while I was gone? Andrea looked surprised.
Why, yes. Horace and I played ball.
She bent down without the slightest wince of pain. A movement she would only a week ago have claimed was impossible for her, and held out one hand. Horace came to her and allowed his head to be stroked.
He's very good at fetching.
2. In her room, Andrea settled on her bed, opened the Vader file, and began to read through it again. More carefully this time. When she finally slid the papers back into the manila envelope, it was close to 2 a.m. She put the envelope into the drawer of the table next to her bed. Also in the drawer was a .38 pistol which her brother Douglas had given her for her birthday 2 years ago. She had been dismayed, but Dougie had insisted that a woman living alone should have protection. Now she took it out, popped the cylinder, and checked the chambers. The one that would roll under the hammer when the trigger was pulled for the first time was empty, as per Twitch's instructions. The other five were full. She had more bullets on the top shelf of her closet, but they would never give her a chance to reload. His little army of cops would shoot her down first. And if she couldn't kill Rennie with 5 shots, she probably didn't deserve to live anyway.
After all, she murmured as she put the gun back in the drawer, what did I get straight for anyway?
The answer seemed clear now that the oxy had cleared her brain. She'd gotten straight to shoot straight.
Amen to that, she said, and turned out the light.
5 minutes later, she was asleep. 3. Junior was wide awake. He sat by the window in the hospital room's only chair, watching the bizarre pink moon decline and slip behind a black smudge on the dome that was new to him. This one was bigger, and much higher than the one left by the failed missile strikes. Had there been some other effort to breach the dome while he'd been unconscious? He didn't know, and didn't care. What mattered was that the dome was still holding. If it hadn't been, the town would have been lit like Vegas and crawling with G.I. Joes. Oh, there were lights here and there, marking a few diehard insomniacs. But for the most part, Chester's Mill slept. That was good, because he had things to think about. Namely, Barbie and Barbie's friends. Junior had no headache as he sat by the window, and his memories had come back. But he was aware that he was a very sick boy. There was a suspicious weakness all down the left side of his body, and sometimes spit slipped from that side of his mouth. If he wiped it away with his left hand, sometimes he could feel skin against skin, and sometimes he couldn't. In addition to this, there was a dark keyhole shape, quite large, floating on the left side of his vision, as if something had torn inside that eyeball. He supposed it had. He could remember the wild rage he'd felt on Dome Day, could remember chasing Angie down the hall to the kitchen, throwing her against the fridge and hoiking his knee into her face. He could remember the sound it made as if there were a china platter behind her eyes and his knee had shattered it. That rage was gone now. What had taken its place was a silken fury that flowed through his body from some bottomless source deep inside his head, a spring that simultaneously chilled and clarified. The old fuck he and Frankie had rousted at Chester Pond had come in to examine him earlier this evening. The old fuck acted professional, taking his temperature and blood pressure, asking how his headache was, even checking his knee reflexes with a little rubber hammer. Then, after he left, Junior heard talk and laughter. Barbie's name was mentioned. Junior crept to the door. It was the old fuck in one of the candy stripers, the pretty Dago, whose name was Buffalo or something like Buffalo. The old fuck had her top open and was feeling her tits. She had his fly open and was jerking his dick. A poison green light surrounded them.
Junior and his friend beat me up, the old fuck was saying. But now his friend's dead and soon he will be too. Barbie's orders.
I like to suck Barbie's dick like a peppermint stick, the buffalo girl said, and the old fox said he enjoyed that too.
Then, when Junior blinked his eyes, the two of them were just walking down the hall. No green aura, no dirty stuff. So maybe it had been hallucination. On the other hand, maybe not. One thing was for sure, they were all in it together. All in league with Barbie. He was in jail, but that was just temporary. To gain sympathy, probably. All part of Barbie's plan. Plus, he thought in that jail he was beyond Junior's reach. Wrong, he whispered as he sat by the window, looking out at the night with his now defective vision. Wrong. Junior knew exactly what had happened to him. It had come in a flash, and the logic was undeniable. He was suffering from thallium poisoning, like what had happened to that Russian guy in England. Barbie's dog tags had been coated with thallium dust, and Junior had handled them, and now he was dying. And since his father had sent him to Barbie's apartment, that meant he was a part of it, too. He was another of Barbie's... his... what did you call those guys? Minions, Junior whispered. Just another one of Big Jim Rennie's filet minions. Once you thought about it, once your mind was clarified, it made perfect sense. His father wanted to shut him up about Coggins and Perkins, hence thallium poisoning. It all hung together. Outside beyond the lawn, a wolf loped across the parking lot. On the lawn itself, two naked women were in the 69 position. 69 lunchtime, he and Frankie used to chant when they were kids. Then saw two girls walking together, not knowing what it meant, only knowing that it was rude. One of the crack snackers looked like Sammy Bushy. The nurse, Ginny her name was, had told him that Sammy was dead, which was obviously a lie, and meant that Ginny was in on it too, in on it with Barbie. Was there anyone in this whole town who wasn't? Who he could be sure wasn't? Yes, he realized. There were two. The kids he and Frank had found out by the pond, Alice and Aiden Appleton. He remembered their haunted eyes, and how the girl had hugged him when he picked her up. When he told her she was safe, she had asked, "Do you promise?" And Junior had told her yes. It made him feel really good to promise. The trusting weight of her had made him feel good, too. He made a sudden decision. He would kill Dale Barbara. If anyone got in his way, he would kill them, too. Then he would find his father and kill him. A thing he had dreamed of doing for years, although he had never admitted it to himself fully until now. Once that was done, he'd seek out Aiden and Alice. If someone tried to stop him, he'd kill them too. He would take the kids back out to Chester Pond, and he would take care of them. He would keep the promise he had made to Alice. If he did, he wouldn't die. God would not let him die of thallium poisoning while he was taking care of those kids. Now Angie McCain and Dodie Sanders went prancing across the parking lot, wearing cheerleader skirts and sweaters with Big Mills Wildcats W's on their chests. They saw him looking and began to gyrate their hips and lift up their skirts. Their faces slopped and jiggled with decay. They were chanting, "Open up the pantry door. Come on in, let's fuck some more. Go team." Junior closed his eyes, opened them. His girlfriends were gone. Another hallucination like the wolf. About the 69 girls, he wasn't so sure. Maybe he thought he wouldn't take the children out to the pond after all. That was pretty far from town. Maybe he would take them to the McCain pantry instead. That was closer. There was plenty of food. And, of course, it was dark. "I'll take care of you kids," Junior said. "I'll keep you safe. Once Barbie's dead, the whole conspiracy will fall apart." After a while, he leaned his forehead against the glass, and then he too slept. 4. Henrietta Clabbard's ass might only have been bruised instead of broken, but it still hurt like a son of a bitch. At 84, she'd found everything that went wrong with you hurt like a son of a bitch. And at first she thought it was her ass that woke her at first light on that Thursday morning. But the Tylenol she'd taken at 3 a.m. still seemed to be holding. Plus, she found her late husband's fanny ring. John Clabbard had suffered hemorrhoids. And that helped considerably. No, it was something else. And shortly after awakening, she realized what it was. The Freeman's Irish setter, Buddy, was howling. Buddy never howled. He was the most polite dog on Battle Street, a short lane just beyond Catherine Russell Drive. Also, the Freeman's generator had stopped. Henrietta thought that might have actually been what woke her up, not the dog. Certainly it had put her to sleep last night. It wasn't one of those rackety ones blowing blue exhaust smoke into the air. The Freeman's generator gave off a low, sleek purr that was actually quite soothing. Henrietta supposed it was expensive, but the Freemans could afford it. Will owned the Toyota franchise Big Jim Rennie had once coveted, and although these were hard times for most car dealers, Will had always seemed the exception to the rule. Just last year, he and Lois had put a very nice and tasteful addition on the house. But that howling! The dog sounded hurt. A hurt pet was the sort of thing nice people like the Freemans saw to immediately. So why weren't they? Henrietta got out of bed, wincing a little as her butt came out of the comforting hole in the foam donut, and went to the window. She could see the Freeman's split level perfectly well, although the light was gray and listless instead of sharp and clear, as it usually was on mornings in late October. From the window she could hear Buddy even better, but she couldn't see anyone moving around over there. The house was entirely dark, not so much as a Coleman lantern glowing in a single window. She would have thought they'd gone somewhere, but both cars were parked in the driveway. And where was there to go, anyway? Buddy continued to howl. Henrietta got on her house coat and slippers and went outside. As she was standing on the sidewalk, a car pulled up. It was Douglas Twitchell, no doubt on his way to the hospital. He looked puffy-eyed and was clutching a takeout cup of coffee with the Sweetbriar Rose logo on the side as he got out of his car. "You all right, Mrs. Clabbard?"
"Yes, but something's wrong at the Freemans. Hear that?"
"Yeah."
"Then so must they. The cars are there, so why don't they stop it?"
"I'll take a look."
Twitch took a sip of his coffee, then set it down in the hood of his car.
"You stay here."
"Nonsense," said Henrietta Clabbard.
They walked down 20 yards or so of sidewalk, then up the Freeman's driveway. The dog howled and howled. The sound of it made Henrietta's skin cold in spite of the morning's limp warmth.
"The air's very bad," she said. "It smells like Rumford used to when I was just married and all the paper mills were still running. This can't be good for people."
Twitch grunted and rang the Freeman's bell. When that brought no response, he first knocked on the door and then hammered.
"See if it's unlocked," Henrietta said.
"I don't know if I should, Mrs.—"
"Oh, bosh."
She pushed past him and tried the knob. It turned. She opened the door. The house beyond it was silent and full of deep early morning shadows.
"Will,"
she called.
"Lois, are you here?"
No one answered but more howls.
"The dog's out back," Twitch said.
It would have been quicker to cut straight through, but neither of them liked to do that, so they walked up the driveway and along the breezeway between the house and the garage, where Will stored not his cars but his toys. 2 snowmobiles, an ATV, a Yamaha dirt bike, and a bloated Honda Goldwing. There was a high-privacy fence around the Freeman backyard. The gate was beyond the breezeway. Twitch pulled the gate open and was immediately hit by 70 pounds of frantic Irish setter. He shouted in surprise and raised his hands, but the dog didn't want to bite him. Buddy was in full please-rescue-me mode. He put his paws on the front of Twitch's last clean tunic, smearing it with dirt, and began to slobber all over his face.
"Stop it!"
Twitch shouted. He pushed Buddy, who went down, but popped right back up, laying fresh tracks on Twitch's tunic and swabbing his cheeks with a long pink tongue.
"Buddy, down!"
Henrietta commanded, and Buddy shrank onto his haunches at once, whining and rolling his eyes between them. A puddle of urine began to spread out beneath him.
"Mrs. Clabbard, this is not good."
"No," Henrietta agreed.
"Maybe you better stay with the duh."
Henrietta once more said bosh and marched into the Freeman's backyard, leaving Twitch to catch up with her. Buddy slunk along behind them, head down and tail tucked, whining disconsolately. There was a stone flag patio with a barbecue on it. The barbecue was neatly covered with a green tarp that said, "The kitchen's closed." Beyond this, on the edge of the lawn, was a redwood platform. On top of the platform was the Freeman's hot tub. Twitch supposed the high-privacy fence was there so they could sit in it naked. Maybe even pitch a little woo if the urge took them. Will and Lois
were in it now, but their woo-pitching days were done. They were wearing clear plastic bags over their heads. The bags appeared to have been cinched at the necks with either twine or brown rubber bands. They had fogged up on the inside, but not so much that Twitch couldn't make out the empurpled faces. Sitting on the redwood apron between the earthly remains of Will and Lois Freeman was a whiskey bottle and a small medicine vial.
"Stop," he said.
He didn't know if he was talking to himself or Mrs. Clavert or possibly to Buddy, who had just voiced another bereft howl. Certainly he couldn't be talking to the Freemans. Henrietta didn't stop. She walked to the hot tub, marched up the two steps with her back as straight as a soldier's, looked at the discolored faces of her perfectly nice and perfectly normal, she would have said, neighbors, glanced at the whiskey bottle, saw it was Glenlivet. At least they'd gone out in style. Then picked up the medicine vial with its Sanders hometown drug label.
"Ambien or Lunesta?" Twitch asked heavily.
"Ambien," she said,
and was gratified the voice emerging from her dry throat and mouth sounded normal.
"Hers. Although, I guess she shared it last night."
"Is there a note?"
"Not here," she said. "Maybe inside."
But there wasn't. At least not in any of the obvious places, and neither of them could think of a reason to hide a suicide note. Buddy followed them from room to room, not howling, but whining, deep in his throat.
"I guess I'll bring him back to house with me," Henrietta said.
"You'll have to. I can't take him to the hospital. I'll call Stuart Bowie to come and get them."
He hooked a thumb back over his shoulder. His stomach was roiling, but that wasn't the bad part. The bad part was the depression that came stealing into him, putting a shadow across his normally sunny soul.
"I don't understand why they would do it," Henrietta said. "If we'd been a year under the dome, or even a month, yes, maybe, but less than a week. This is not how stable people respond to trouble."
Twitch thought he understood, but didn't want to say it to Henrietta. It was going to be a month. It was going to be a year. Maybe longer, and with no rain, fewer resources, and fouler air. If the most technologically hip country in the world hadn't been able to get a handle on what had happened at Chester's Mill by now, let alone solve the problem, it probably wasn't going to happen soon. Will Freeman must have understood that. Or maybe it had been Lois's idea. Maybe when the generator had died, she'd said, "Let's do it before the water in the hot tub gets cold, honey. Let's get out from under the dome while our bellies are still full. What do you say? One more dip, with a few drinks to see us off."
"Maybe it was the plane that pushed them over the edge," Twitch said, "the Aer Lingus that hit the dome yesterday."
Henrietta didn't answer with words. She hawked back and spat snot into the kitchen sink. It was a somehow shocking gesture of repudiation. They went back outside.
"More people will do this, won't they?" she asked, when they had reached the end of the driveway. "Because suicide gets in the air sometimes like a cold germ."
"Some already have."
Twitch didn't know if suicide was painless, as the song said, but under the right circumstances it could certainly be catching. Maybe especially catching when the situation was unprecedented and the air started to smell as foul as it did on this windless, unnaturally warm morning.
"Suicides are cowards," Henrietta said. "A rule to which there are no exceptions, Douglas."
Twitch, whose father had died a long and lingering death as a result of stomach cancer, wondered about that but said nothing. Henrietta bent to Buddy with her hands on her bony knees. Buddy stretched his neck up to sniff her.
"Come next door, my furry friend. I have 3 eggs. You may eat them before they go bad."
She started away, then turned back to Twitch.
"They are cowards," she said,
giving each word its own special emphasis. 5. Jim Rennie checked out of Kathy Russell, slept soundly in his own bed, and woke refreshed. Although he would not have admitted it to anyone, part of the reason was knowing Junior was out of the house. Now, at 8 o'clock, his black Hummer was parked a door or two up from Rosie's, in front of a fire hydrant, but what the hell, currently there was no fire department. He was having breakfast with Peter Randolph, Mel Searles, Freddie Denton, and Carter Thibodeau.
Carter had taken up what was becoming his usual station, at Big Jim's right hand. He wore two guns this morning, his own on his hip, and Linda Everett's recently returned Beretta Taurus in a shoulder rig. The quintet had taken over the bullshit table at the back of the restaurant, deposing the regulars without a qualm. Rose wouldn't come near. She sent Anson to deal with them. Big Jim ordered 3 fried eggs, double sausage, and home toast fried and bacon grease, the way his mother used to serve it. He knew he was supposed to be cutting down on his cholesterol, but today he was going to need all the energy he could pack in. The next few days, actually. After that, things would be under control. He could go to work on his cholesterol then. A fable he had been telling himself for 10 years. "Where's the Bowies?" he asked Carter. "I wanted the gosh darn Bowies here, so where are they?"
"Had to roll in a call out to Battle Street," Carter said. "Mr. and Mrs. Freeman committed suicide."
"That cotton picker topped himself?" Big Jim exclaimed.
The few patrons, most at the counter watching CNN, looked around, then looked away.
"Well, there. I'm not a bit surprised."
It occurred to him that now the Toyota dealership could be his for the taking. But why would he want it? A much bigger plum had fallen into his lap. The whole town. He had already started drafting a list of executive orders, which he would begin putting into effect as soon as he was granted full executive powers. That would happen tonight. And besides, he had hated that smarmy son of a Buck Freeman and his titsy rhymes with witch wife for years.
"Boys, he and Lois are eating breakfast in heaven."
He paused, then burst out laughing. Not very political, but he just couldn't help it.
"In the servants' quarters, I have no doubt."
"While the Bowies were out there, they got another call," Carter said. "Dinsmore Farm. Another suicide."
"Who?"
Chief Randolph asked. "Arlen?"
"No. His wife. Shelley."
That actually was sort of a shame.
"Let us bow our heads for a minute," Big Jim said, and extended his hands.
Carter took one. Mel Searles took the other. Randolph and Denton linked up.
"Oh, God, please bless these poor souls, Jesus' sake, amen," Big Jim said, and raised his head.
"Little business, Peter." Peter hauled out his notebook. Carter's was already laid beside his plate. Big Jim liked the boy more and more.
"I've found the missing propane," Big Jim announced. "It's a WCIK.
"Jesus," Randolph said. "We have to send some trucks out there to get it."
"Yes, but not today," Big Jim said. "Tomorrow, while everyone's visiting their relatives. I've already started working on that. The Bowies and Roger will go out again, but we'll need a few officers, too. Fred, you and Mel. Plus, I'm going to say 4 or 5 more. Not you, Carter. I want you with me."
"Why do you need cops to get a bunch of propane tanks?" Randolph said.
"Well," Jim said, mopping up egg yolk with a piece of fried toast. "That goes back to our friend Dale Barbara and his plans to destabilize this town. There are a couple of armed men out there, and it looks like they may be protecting some kind of drug lab. I think Barbara had that in place long before he actually showed up in person. This was well planned. One of the current caretakers is Philip Bushy."
"That loser," Randolph grunted.
"The other one, I'm sorry to say, is Andy Sanders."
Randolph had been spearing fried potatoes. Now he dropped his fork with a clatter.
"Andy?" "Sad but true. It was Barbara who set him up in business. I have that on good authority. But don't ask me for my source. He's requested anonymity."
Big Jim sighed, then stuffed a yolk-smeared chunk of fried bread into his cake hole. Dear Lord, but he felt good this morning.
"I suppose Andy needed the money. I understand the bank was on the verge of foreclosing his drugstore. He never did have a head for business."
"The town government, either," Freddie Denton added.
Big Jim ordinarily did not enjoy being interrupted by inferiors, but this morning he was enjoying everything.
"Unfortunately true," he said, then leaned over the table as far as his large belly would allow. "He and Bushy shot at one of the trucks I sent out there yesterday. Blew the front tires. Those cotton pickers are dangerous."
"Drug addicts with guns," Randolph said. "A law enforcement nightmare. The men who go out there will have to wear vests."
"Good idea.
And I
can't vouch for Andy's safety.
God love you, I know that. Do what you have to do. We need that propane. The town's crying for it. And I intend to announce at the meeting tonight that we've discovered a fresh source.
Are you sure I can't go, Mr. Rennie? Carter asked.
I know it's a disappointment to you, but I want you with me tomorrow night out where they're having their visitors' party. Randolph, too, I think. Someone has to coordinate this business, which is apt to be a cluster mug. We'll have to try to keep people from being trampled. Although some probably will be, because people don't know how to behave.
Better tell Twitchell to get his ambulance out there. Carter wrote this down.
While he did, Big Jim turned back to Randolph. His face was long with sorrow.
I hate to say this, Pete, but my informant has suggested Junior may also have been involved with the drug lab.
Junior? Mel said. Nah, not Junior.
Big Jim nodded and wiped a dry eye with the heel of his palm.
It's hard for me to believe, too. I don't want to believe it, but you know, he's in the hospital.
They nodded.
Drug overdose,
Rennie whispered, leaning even further over the table.
That seems to be the most likely explanation for what's wrong with him.
He straightened and focused on Randolph again. Don't try going in from the main road, they'll be expecting that. About a mile east of the radio station, there's an access road.
I know the one, Freddy said. There used to be Sloppy Sam Verdreau's woodlot out there, before the bank took it back. I think now all that land belongs to Holy Redeemer.
Big Jim smiled and nodded, although the land actually belonged to a Nevada corporation of which he was president.
Go in that way, then approach the station from the rear. There's mostly old growth out there, and you should have no trouble.
Big Jim's cell phone rang. He looked at the display, almost let the phone ring over to voicemail, then thought,
what the heck? Feeling as he did this morning, listening to Cox foam at the mouth might be enjoyable.
This is Rennie. What do you want, Colonel Cox?
He listened, his smile fading a little.
How do I know you're telling the truth about this?
He listened some more, then ended the call without saying goodbye. He sat frowning for a moment, processing whatever he'd heard. Then he raised his head and spoke to Randolph.
Do we have a Geiger counter? In the fallout shelter, maybe?
Gee, I don't know. Al Timmons probably would.
Find him and have him check that out.
Is it important?
Randolph asked. And at the same time, Carter asked,
is it radiation, boss?
It's nothing to worry about, Big Jim said. As Junior would say, he's just trying to freak me out, I'm sure of it. But check on that Geiger counter. If we do have one and it still works, bring it to me.
Okay,
Randolph said, looking frightened. Big Jim wished now that he'd let the call go to voicemail after all, or kept his mouth shut. Searles was apt to blab about this, start a rumor. Heck, Randolph was apt to. And it was probably nothing, just that brass hat cotton picker trying to spoil a good day. The most important day of his life, maybe. Freddy Denton, at least, had kept what mind he had on the issue at hand.
What time do you want us to hit the radio station, Mr. Rennie?
Big Jim mentally reran what he knew about the visitor's day schedule, then smiled. It was a genuine smile, wreathing his slightly greasy chops with good cheer and revealing his tiny teeth.
12 o'clock. Everybody will be schmoozing out on Highway 119 by then, and the rest of the town will be empty. So you go in and take out those cotton pickers sitting on our propane at high noon, just like in one of those old Western movies.
6. At 11:15 on that Thursday morning, the Sweet Briar Rose van went trundling south along Route 119. Tomorrow the highway would be clogged with cars and stinking of exhaust, but today it was eerily deserted. Sitting behind the wheel was Rose herself. Ernie Calvert was in the passenger bucket. Nori sat between them on the engine housing, clutching her skateboard, which was covered with stickers bearing the logos of long-gone punk bands like Stalag 17 and the Dead Milkmen.
The air smells so bad, Nori said.
It's the pressed steel, honey, Rose said. It's turned into a big old stinky marsh where it used to run into Martin. She knew it was more than just the smell of the dying river, but didn't say so. They had to breathe, so there was no point in worrying about what they might be breathing in.
Have you talked to your mother?
Yeah.
Nori said glumly.
She'll come, but she's not crazy about the idea.
Will she bring whatever groceries she has when it's time?
Yes, in the trunk of our car.
What Nori didn't add was that Joni Calvert would load in her booze supply first. Food supplies would play second fiddle to that.
What about the radiation, Rose? We can't plaster every car that goes up there with lead roll.
If people only go once or twice, they should be okay. Rose had confirmed this for herself on the internet. She had also discovered that safety when it came to radiation depended on the strength of the rays, but saw no sense in worrying them about things they couldn't control.
The important thing is to limit exposure.
And Joe says the belt isn't wide.
Joey's mom won't want to come,
Nori said. Rose sighed. This, she knew, Visitor's Day was a mixed blessing. It might cover their retreat, but those with relatives on the other side would want to see them. Maybe McClatchy will lose the lottery, she thought. Up ahead was Jim Rennie's used cars, with its big sign. You'll love the feeling when Big Jim is dealing. Ask us for credit. Remember, Ernie began. I know, Rose said. If someone's there, just turn around in front and head back to town. But at Rennie's, all the reserved for employee slots were empty. The showroom was deserted, and there was a whiteboard bearing the message closed until further notice, hanging on the main door. Rose drove around back in a hurry. Out here were ranks of cars and trucks with signs in the windows bearing prices and slogans like Great Value, and Clean as a Whistle, and Hey, Look Me Over, with the O's turned into sexy, long-lash girl eyes. These were the battered workhorses in Big Jim's stable. Nothing like the snazzy Detroit and German thoroughbreds out front. At the far end of the lot, ranked against the chain-link fence separating Big Jim's property from a trash-littered patch of second-growth woods, was a line of phone company vans, some still bearing AT&T logos.
Those, Ernie said, reaching behind his seat.
He brought out a long, thin strip of metal.
That's a Slim Jim, Rose said, amused in spite of her nerves. Why would you have a Slim Jim, Ernie?
From when I was still working at Food City, you'd be surprised how many people lock their keys in their cars.
How will you get it started, Grandpa?
Nori asked. Ernie smiled feebly.
I'll figure something out. Stop here, Rose.
He got out and trotted to the first van, moving with surprising nimbleness for a man approaching 70. He peered through the window, shook his head, and went to the next in line. Then the third, but that one had a flat tire. After a look into the fourth, he turned back to Rose and gave her a thumbs up.
Go on, Rose, buzz.
Rose had an idea that Ernie didn't want his granddaughter seeing him use the Slim Jim. She was touched by that, and drove back around to the front without any further talk. Here she stopped again.
You okay with this, sweetie?
Yes,
Nori said, getting out.
If you can't get it started, we'll just walk back to town.
It's almost 3 miles. Can you do that? Nori's face was pale, but she managed to smile.
Grandpa could walk me right into the ground. He does 4 miles a day, says it keeps his joints oiled. Go on now, before someone comes and sees you.
You're a brave girl, Rose said.
I don't feel brave.
Brave people never do, honey. Rose drove back toward town. Nori watched until she was out of sight, then began to do rails and lazy diamonds in the front lot. The hot top had a slight slope, so she only had to piss pedal one way. Although she was so wired, she felt like she could push the board all the way uptown Common Hill and not feel it. Hell, right now she could probably ass knife and not feel it. And if someone came along, well, she had walked out here with her grandpa, who wanted to look at some vans. She was just waiting for him. Then they'd walk back to town. Grandpa loved to walk, everybody knew that. Oiling the joints. Except Nori didn't think that was all of it, or even most of it. He had started doing his walks when Grandma started getting confused about stuff. No one came right out and said it was Alzheimer's, although everyone knew. Nori thought he was walking off his sorrow. Was such a thing possible? She thought it was. She knew that when she was riding her skateboard, pulling off some sick double kink at the skate park in Oxford, there was no room in her for anything but joy and fear. And joy ruled the house. Fear lived in the shack out back. After a short while that felt long, the ex-phone company van rolled from behind the building with Grandpa at the wheel. Nori tucked her skateboard under her arm and jumped in. Her first ride in a stolen vehicle.
"Grandpa, you are so gnarly," she said, and kissed him.
7. Joe McClatchy was headed for the kitchen, wanting one of the remaining cans of apple juice in their dead refrigerator, when he heard his mother say bump, and stopped. He knew that his parents had met in college at the University of Maine, and that back then Sam McClatchy's friends had called him Bump. But Mom hardly ever called him that anymore. And when she did, she laughed and blushed, as if the nickname had some sort of dirty subtext. About that, Joe didn't know. What he knew was that for her to slip like that, slip back like that, must mean she was upset. He came a little closer to the kitchen door. It was chalked open, and he could see his mother and Jackie Weddington, who was today dressed in a blouse and faded jeans instead of her uniform. They'd be able to see him, too, if they looked up. He had no intention of actually sneaking around. That wouldn't be cool, especially if his mom was upset. But for the time being, they were only looking at each other. They were seated at the kitchen table. Jackie was holding Claire's hands. Joe saw that his mother's eyes were wet, and that made him feel like crying himself. "You can't," Jackie was saying. "I know you want to, but you just can't. Not if things go like they're supposed to tonight."
"Can I at least call him and tell him why I won't be there, or email him? I could do that."
Jackie shook her head. Her face was kind but firm. "He might talk, and the talk might get back to Rennie. If Rennie sniffs something in the wind before we break Barbie and Rusty out, we could have a total disaster on our hands."
"If I tell him to keep it strictly to himself. But Claire, don't you see? There's too much at stake. Two men's lives, ours too."
She paused.
"Your son's."
Claire's shoulders sagged, then straightened again.
"You take Joe, then. I'll come after Visitor's Day. Rennie won't suspect me. I don't know Dale Barber from Adam, and I don't know Rusty either, except to say hi to on the street. I go to Dr. Hartwell over in Castle Rock."
"But Joe knows Barbie," Jackie said patiently. "Joe was the one who set up the video feed when they shot the missiles. And Big Jim knows that. Don't you think he might take you into custody and sweat you until you told him where we went?"
"I wouldn't," Claire said. "I would never tell."
Joe came into the kitchen. Claire wiped her cheeks and tried to smile.
"Oh, hi, honey. We were just talking about Visitor's Day and..."
"Mom, he might not just sweat you," Joe said. "He might torture you."
She looked shocked.
"Oh, he wouldn't do that. I know he's not a nice man, but he's a town selectman after all, and..."
"He was a town selectman," Jackie said. "Now he's auditioning for Emperor. And sooner or later everybody talks. Do you want Joe to be somewhere imagining you having your fingernails pulled out?"
"Stop it," Claire said. "That's horrible."
Jackie didn't let go of Claire's hands when Claire tried to pull them back.
"It's all or nothing, and it's too late to be nothing. This thing is in motion, and we've got to move with it. If it was just Barbie escaping by himself with no help from us, Big Jim might actually let him go, because every dictator needs a boogeyman. But it won't just be him, will it? And that means he'll try to find us and wipe us out."
"I wish I'd never gotten into this. I wish I'd never gone to that meeting and never let Joe go."
"But we've got to stop him," Joe protested. "Mr. Rennie's trying to turn the mill into a, you know, police state."
"I can't stop anybody," Claire nearly wailed. "I'm a goddamn housewife." "If it's any comfort," Jackie said, "you probably had a ticket for this trip as soon as the kids found that box."
"It's not a comfort, it's not."
"In some ways, we're even lucky," Jackie went on. "We haven't sucked too many innocent people into this with us. At least not yet."
"Rennie and his police force will find us anyway," Claire said. "Don't you know that? There's only so much town in this town."
Jackie smiled mirthlessly. "By then, there'll be more of us, with more guns. And Rennie will know it."
"We have to take over the radio station as soon as we can," Joe said. "People need to hear the other side of the story. We have to broadcast the truth."
Jackie's eyes lit up.
"That's a hell of a good idea, Joe." "Dear God," Claire said.
She put her hands over her face.
8. Ernie pulled the phone company van up to the Burpees loading dock. "I'm a criminal now," he thought,
and my 12-year-old granddaughter is my accomplice. Or is she 13 now? It didn't matter. He didn't think Peter Randolph would treat her as a juvenile if they were caught. Romy opened the rear door, saw it was them, and came out onto the loading dock with guns in both hands.
Have any trouble?
Smooth as silk, Ernie said, mounting the steps of the dock. There's nobody on the roads. Have you got more guns?
Yeah, a few. Inside back of the door. You help too, Miss Norrie.
Norrie picked up two rifles and handed them to her grandpa, who stowed them in the back of the van. Romy rolled a dolly out to the loading dock. On it were a dozen lead rolls.
We don't need to unload this right now, he said. I'll just cut some pieces for the windows. We'll do the windshield once we get out there. Leave a slit to see through, like an old Sherman tank, and drive that way. Norrie, while Ernie and I do this, see if you can push that other dolly out. If you can, just leave it, and we'll get it after.
The other dolly was loaded with cartons of food, most of it canned stuff or pouches of concentrate meant for campers. One box was stuffed with envelopes of cut-rate powdered drink mix. The dolly was heavy, but once she got it moving, it rolled easily. Stopping it was another matter. If Romy hadn't reached up and shoved from where he was standing at the back of the van, the dolly might have gone right off the dock. Ernie had finished blocking the stolen van's small rear windows with pieces of lead roll held by generous applications of masking tape. Now he wiped his brow and said,
"This is risky as hell, Burpee. We're planning on a damn convoy out to the McCoy Orchard."
Romy shrugged, then began loading in cartons of supplies, lining the walls of the van and leaving the middle open for the passengers they hoped to have later. A tree of sweat was growing on the back of his shirt.
"We just gotta hope if we do it quick and quiet, the big meeting covers for us. Don't have much choice."
"Will Julia and Mrs. McClatchy get lead on their car windows?" Norrie asked.
"Yeah, this afternoon. I'll help them. And then they'll have to leave their cars behind the store. Can't go sporting around town with lead-lined car windows. People will ask questions."
"What about that escalator of yours?" Ernie asked. "That'd swallow the rest of these supplies without so much as a burp. Your wife could drive it out."
"Misha won't come," Romy said. "Won't have nothing to do with it. I asked, did all but get down on my knees and beg, but I might as well have been a gust of wind blowing round the house. I guess I already knew, because I didn't tell her no more than she knew already. Which isn't much, but won't keep her out of trouble if Rennie comes down on her. But she won't see it.
Why won't she?"
Norrie asked, eyes wide, aware that the question might be rude, only after it was out and she saw her grandpa frown.
"Because she's one stubborn honey. I told her she might get hurt.
Like to see him try," she said. "That's my Misha."
"Well, hell. If I get a chance later on, I may sneak down and see if she'd change her mind. They say it's a woman's prerogative. Come on. And let's put in a few more of those boxes. And don't cover up the guns, Ernie. We might need them."
"I can't believe I got you into this, kiddo," Ernie said.
"It's okay, Grandpa. I'd rather be in than out."
And this much, at least, was true. 9. Bonk. Silence. Bonk. Silence. Bonk. Silence. Ollie Dinsmore sat cross-legged 4 feet from the dome with his old Boy Scout pack beside him. The pack was full of rocks he'd picked up in the dooryard. So full, in fact, that he'd staggered down here rather than walked, thinking that the canvas bottom would tear out of the pack and spill his ammo. But it hadn't, and here he was. He selected another rock. A nice smooth one, polished by some ancient glacier, and threw it overhand at the dome. Where it struck what appeared to be thin air and bounced back. He picked it up and threw it again. Bonk. Silence. The dome had one thing going for it, he thought. It might be the reason his brother and his mother were dead, but by the hairy old Jesus, one load of ammunition was enough to last all day. Rock boomerangs, he thought, and smiled. It was a real smile, but it made him look somehow terrible because his face was far too thin. He hadn't been eating much, and he thought it would be a good long while before he felt like eating again. Hearing a shot and then finding your mother lying beside the kitchen table with her dress flipped up to show her underpants and half her head blown off, nothing like that did nothing for a fellow's appetite. Bonk.
Silence. The other side of the dome was a hive of activity. A tent city had sprung up. Jeeps and trucks scooted to and fro, and hundreds of military guys went buzzing around, while their superiors shouted orders and cussed them out, often in the same breath. In addition to the tents that had already been erected, three long new ones were being put up. The signs already planted in front of them read, Visitors Hospitality Station 1, Visitors Hospitality Station 2, and First Aid Station. Another tent, even longer, had a sign in front of it reading, Light Refreshments. And shortly after, Ollie sat down and began tossing his trove of rocks at the dome. Two flatbed trucks loaded with porta-potties had arrived. Now ranks of cheery-looking blue shithouses stood over there, well away from the area where relatives would stand to speak with loved ones they could look at but not touch. The stuff that had come out of his mother's head had looked like moldy strawberry jam, and what Ollie couldn't understand was why she'd done it that way and in that place. Why in the room where they ate most of their meals? Had she been so far gone that she hadn't realized she had another son, who might eat again, assuming he didn't starve to death first, but who would never forget the horror of what lay there on the floor? Yep, he thought. That far gone. Because Rory was always her favorite, her pet. She hardly knew I was around. Unless I forgot to feed the cows or swab out the stalls when they were afield. Or if I brought home a D on my rank card. Because he never got anything but A's. He threw a rock. Bonk. Silence. There were several army guys putting up pairs of signs over there near the dome. The ones facing in toward the mill read, Warning. For your own safety, keep 2 yards, 6 feet, from the dome. Ollie guessed the signs pointing the other way said the same, and on the other side they might work, because on the other side there would be lots of guys to keep order. Over here, though, there were going to be maybe 800 townies and maybe 2 dozen cops. Most of them new to the job. Keeping people back on this side would be like trying to protect a sandcastle from the incoming tide. Her underpants had been wet, and there had been a puddle between her splayed legs. She'd pissed herself either right before she pulled the trigger or right after. Ollie thought probably after. He threw a rock. Bonk. Silence. There was one army guy close by. He was pretty young. There wasn't any kind of insignia on his sleeve, so Ollie guessed he was probably a private. He looked about 16. But Ollie supposed he had to be older. He'd heard of kids lying about their age to get into the service, but he guessed that was before everybody had computers to keep track of such things. The army guy looked around, saw no one was paying him any attention, and spoke in a low voice. He had a southern accent. Kid, would y'all stop doing that? It's driving me bug shit. Go someplace else then, Ollie said. Bonk. Silence. Kane, orders. Ollie didn't reply. He threw another rock instead. Bonk. Silence. Why y'all doing it? The army guy asked. He was now just fiddling with the pair of signs he was putting up so he could talk to Ollie. Because sooner or later one of them won't bounce back. And when that happens, I'm going to get up and walk away and never see this farm again. Never milk another cow. What's the air like out there?
Good. Chilly, though. I'm from South Carolina. It ain't like this in South Carolina in October, I can tell you that.
Where Ollie was, less than 3 yards from the southern boy, it was hot. Also stinky. The army guy pointed beyond Ollie.
Why don't y'all quit on the rocks and do something about those cows?
He said it, cows.
Herd them into the barn and milk them, or rub soothing shit in their udders, something like that.
We don't need to herd them. They know where to go. Only now they don't need to be milked, and they don't need any bag balm either. Their udders are dry.
Yeah?
Yeah. My dad says something's wrong with the grass. He says the grass is wrong because the air's wrong. It doesn't smell good in here, you know. It smells like crap.
Yeah?
The army guy looked fascinated. He gave the tops of the back-to-back signs a tap or two with his hammer, although they already looked well-seated.
Yeah. My mother killed herself this morning.
The army guy had raised his hammer for another hit. Now he just dropped it to his side.
Are you shitting me, kid?
No, she shot herself at the kitchen table. I found her.
Oh, fuck, that's rough.
The army guy approached the dome. We took my brother to town when he died last Sunday because he was still alive, a little. But my mom was dead can be, so we buried her on the knoll. My dad and me. She liked it there. It was pretty there before everything got so cruddy.
Jesus, kid, you've been through hell.
Still there, Ollie said, and as if the words had turned a valve somewhere inside, he began to weep. He got up and went to the dome. He and the young soldier faced each other less than a foot apart. The soldier raised his hand, wincing a little as the transient shock whipped through him and then out of him. He laid his hand on the dome, fingers spread. Ollie lifted his own and pressed it against the dome on his side. Their hands seemed to be touching, finger to finger and palm to palm, but they weren't. It was a futile gesture that would be repeated over and over the following day, hundreds of times, thousands.
Kid.
Private Ames, someone bawled. Get your sorry ass away from there.
Private Ames jumped like a kid who's been caught stealing jam.
Get over here, double time.
Hang in there, kid, Private Ames said, and ran off to get his scolding.
Ollie imagined it had to be a scolding since he couldn't very well demote a private. Surely they wouldn't put him in the stockade or whatever for talking to one of the animals in the zoo. I didn't even get any peanuts, Ollie thought. For a moment he looked up at the cows that no longer gave milk, that hardly even cropped grass, and then he sat down by his pack. He searched for and found another nice round rock. He thought about the chipped polish on the nails of his dead mother's outstretched hand, the one with the still-smoking gun beside it. Then he threw the rock. It hit the dome and bounced back. Bonk. Silence. 10. At 4 o'clock on that Thursday afternoon, while the overcast held over northern New England, and the sun shone down on Chester's Mill like a bleary spotlight through the sock-shaped hole in the clouds, Ginny Tomlinson went to check on Junior. She asked if he needed something for headache. He said no, then changed his mind and asked for some Tylenol or Advil. When she came back, he walked across the room to get it. On his chart, she wrote, "Limp is still present, but seems improved." When Thurston Marshall poked his head in 45 minutes later, the room was empty. He assumed Junior had gone down to the lounge, but when he checked there, it was empty, except for Emily Whitehouse, the heart attack patient. Emily was recovering nicely. Thurst asked her if she'd seen a young man with dark blonde hair and a limp. She said no. Thurst went back to Junior's room and looked in the closet. It was empty. The young man with the probable brain tumor had dressed and checked himself out without benefit of paperwork. 11. Junior walked home. His limp seemed to clear up entirely once his muscles were warm. In addition, the dark keyhole shape floating on the left side of his vision had shrunk to a ball the size of a marble. Maybe he hadn't gotten a full dose of thallium after all. Hard to tell. Either way, he had to keep his promise to God. If he took care of the Appleton kids, then God would take care of him. As he left the hospital by the back door, killing his father had been first on his to-do list. But by the time he actually got to the house where his mother had died, the house where Lester Coggins and Brenda Perkins had died, he had changed his mind. If he killed his father now, the special town meeting would be canceled. Junior didn't want that because the town meeting would provide good cover for his main errand. Most of the cops would be there, and that would make gaining access to the coop easier. He only wished he had the poisoned dog tags. He'd enjoy stuffing them down Barbie's dying throat. Big Jim wasn't at home anyway. The only living thing in the house was the wolf he'd seen loping across the hospital parking lot in the small hours of the morning. It was halfway down the stairs, looking at him and growling deep in its chest. Its fur was ragged, its eyes were yellow. Around its neck hung Dale Barbara's dog tags. Junior closed his eyes and counted to 10. When he opened them, the wolf was gone.
"I'm the wolf now,"
he whispered to the hot and empty house.
"I'm the werewolf, and I saw Lon Chaney dancing with the queen."
He went upstairs, limping again but not noticing. His uniform was in the closet, and so was his gun, a Beretta 92 Taurus. The PD had a dozen of them, mostly paid for with federal Homeland Security money. He checked the Beretta's 15-round mag and saw it was full. He put the gun into its holster, cinched the belt around his shrinking waist, and left his room. At the top of the stairs he paused, wondering where to go until the meeting was well underway and he could make his move. He didn't want to talk to anyone, didn't even want to be seen. Then it came to him, a good hiding place that was also close to the action. He descended the stairs carefully. The goddamn limp was all the way back, plus the left side of his face was so numb it might have been frozen, and lurched down the hall. He stopped briefly outside his father's study, wondering if he should open the safe and burn the money inside. He decided it wasn't worth the effort. He vaguely remembered a joke about bankers marooned on a desert island who'd gotten rich trading each other their clothes, and he uttered a brief yapping laugh, even though he couldn't exactly recall the punchline, and had never completely gotten the joke anyway. The sun had gone down behind the clouds to the west of the dome, and the day had grown gloomy. Junior walked out of the house and disappeared into the murk. 12. At 5:15, Alice and Aiden Appleton came in from the backyard of their borrowed house. Alice said,
"Carol, will you take Aiden and me, to the big meeting?"
Carolyn Sturgis, who had been making PB&J sandwiches for supper on Coralie Dummigen's counter with Coralie Dummigen's bread, stale but edible, looked at the children with surprise. She had never heard of kids wanting to attend an adults' meeting before, would have said if asked that they'd probably run the other way to avoid such a boring event. She was tempted, because if the kids went, she could go.
"Are you sure?"
she asked, bending down.
"Both of you."
Before these last few days, Carolyn would have said she had no interest in having children, that what she wanted was a career as a teacher and a writer, maybe a novelist, although it seemed to her that writing novels was pretty risky. What if you spent all that time, wrote 1,000-pager, and it sucked? Poetry, though. Going around the country, maybe on a motorcycle? Doing readings and teaching seminars, free as a bird? That'd be cool. Maybe meeting a few interesting men, drinking wine, and discussing Sylvia Plath in bed. Alice and Aiden had changed her mind. She had fallen in love with them. She wanted the dome to break, of course she did, but giving these two back to their mom was going to hurt her heart. She sort of hoped it would hurt theirs a little, too. Probably that was mean, but there it was.
"Aid, is it what you want? Because grown-up meetings can be awfully long and boring." "I want to go," Aiden said. "I want to see all the people."
Then Carolyn understood. It wasn't the discussion of resources and how the town was going to use them as it went forward that interested them. Why would it be? Alice was 9 and Aiden was 5. But wanting to see everybody gathered together like a great big extended family, that made sense.
"Can you be good, not squirm and whisper too much?" "Of course," Alice said with dignity. "And will you both pee yourselves dry before we go?" "Yes."
This time the girl rolled her eyes to show what an annoying stupidnik Carol was being. And Carol sort of loved it.
"Then what I'll do is just pack these sandwiches to go," Carolyn said. "And we've got 2 cans of soda for kids who can be good and use straws. Assuming the kids in question have peed themselves dry before dumping any more liquid down their throats, that is."
"I use straws like mad," Aiden said. "Any whoops?"
"He means whoopie pies," Alice said. "I know what he means, but there aren't any. I think there might be some graham crackers, though. The kind with cinnamon sugar on them."
"Cinnamon graham crackers rock," Aiden said. "I love you, Carol."
Carolyn smiled. She thought no poem she'd ever read had been so beautiful. Not even the Williams one, about the cold plums. 13. Andrea Grinnell descended the stairs slowly but steadily while Julia stared in amazement. Andy had undergone a transformation. Makeup and a comb out of the frizzy wreck that had been her hair had played a part, but that wasn't all of it. Looking at her, Julia realized how long it had been since she'd seen the town's 3rd selectman looking like herself. This evening she was wearing a knockout red dress belted at the waist, it looked like Ann Taylor, and carrying a large fabric bag with a drawstring top. Even Horace was gawking.
"How do I look?"
Andy asked when she reached the bottom of the stairs.
"Like I could fly to the town meeting if I had a broom?" "You look great. 20 years younger." "Thanks, hon, but I have a mirror upstairs." "If it didn't show you how much better you look, you better try one down here where the light's better."
Andy switched her bag to her other arm as if it were heavy.
Well, I guess I do. A little, anyway.
Are you sure you have strength enough for this?
I think so, but if I start to shake and shiver, I'll slip out the side door.
Andy had no intention of slipping away, whether she shook or not. What's in the bag? Jim Rennie's lunch, Andrea thought, which I intend to feed him in front of this whole town.
I always take my knitting to town meeting. Sometimes they're just so slow and dull.
I don't think this one will be dull, Julia said.
You're coming, aren't you?
Oh, I imagine, Julia said vaguely. She expected to be well away from downtown Chester's Mill before the meeting ended.
I have a few things to do first.
Can you get there on your own? Andy gave her a comical mother please look.
Down the street, down the hill, and it's right there. Been doing it for years.
Julia looked at her watch. It was 5:45.
Aren't you leaving awfully early? Al will open the doors at 6:00, if I'm not mistaken, and I want to be sure and get a good seat.
As a select woman, you should be right up there on stage, Julia said. If it's what you want.
No, I don't think so.
Andy switched the bag to her other arm again. Her knitting was inside. So was the Vader file and the .38 her brother Twitch had given her for home protection. She thought it would serve just as well for town protection. A town was like a body, but it had one advantage over the human one. If a town had a bad brain, a transplant could be affected. And maybe it wouldn't come to killing. She prayed it wouldn't. Julia was looking at her quizzically. Andrea realized she'd drifted off.
I think I'll just sit with the common folk tonight. But I'll have my say when the time comes.
You can count on that. 14. Andy was right about Al Timmons opening the doors at 6. By then, Main Street, next to Empty All Day, was filling with citizens headed for the town hall. More walked in little groups downtown Common Hill from the residential streets. Cars began to arrive from Eastchester and Northchester, most filled to capacity. No one, it seemed, wanted to be alone tonight. She was early enough to have her pick of seats, and chose the 3rd row from the stage on the aisle. Just ahead of her in the 2nd row were Carolyn Sturges and the Appleton children. The kids were gawking wide-eyed at everything and everyone. The little boy had what appeared to be a graham cracker clutched in his fist. Linda Everett was another early arriver. Julia had told Andy about Rusty being arrested, utterly ridiculous, and knew his wife must be devastated, but she was hiding it well, behind great makeup and a pretty dress with big patch pockets. Given her own situation, mouth dry, head aching, stomach roiling, Andy admired her courage.
"Come sit with me, Linda," she said, patting the spot beside her. "How is Rusty?" "I don't know,"
Linda said, slipping past Andrea and sitting down. Something in one of those amusing pockets clunked on the wood.
"They won't let me see him." "That situation will be rectified," Andrea said.
"Yes," Linda said grimly.
"It will."
Then she leaned forward.
"Hello, kids. What are your names?"
"This is Aiden," Caro said, "and this is..."
"I'm Alice."
The little girl held out a regal hand, queen to loyal subject.
"Me and Aiden, Aiden and I, are Dorphins. That means dome orphans. Thurston made it up. He knows magic tricks like pulling a quarter out of your ear and stuff."
"Well, you seem to have landed on your feet," Linda said, smiling.
She didn't feel like smiling. She had never been so nervous in her life. Only nervous was too mild a word. She was scared shitless. 15. By 6:30, the parking lot behind the town hall was full. After that, the spaces on Main Street went, and those on West Street and East Street. By 6:45, even the post office and FD parking lots were loaded, and almost every seat in the town hall was taken. Big Jim had foreseen the possibility of an overflow, and Al Timmons, assisted by some of the newer cops, had put benches from the American Legion Hall on the lawn. "Support our troops," was printed on some. "Play more bingo," on others. Large Yamaha speakers had been placed on either side of the front door. Most of the town's police force, and all of the veteran cops save one, were present to keep order. When latecomers grumbled about having to sit outside, or stand, when even the benches had filled up, Chief Randolph told them they should have come earlier. If you snooze, you lose. Also, he added, it was a pleasant night, nice and warm, and later there was apt to be another big pink moon.
Pleasant, if you don't mind the smell, Joe Boxer said.
The dentist had been in an unrelievedly crappy mood ever since the confrontation at the hospital over his liberated waffles.
I hope we can hear all right through those things.
He pointed at the speakers.
You'll hear fine, Chief Randolph said. We got them from Dippers. Tommy Anderson says they're state-of-the-art, and he set them up himself. Think of it as a drive-in movie without the picture. I think of it as a pain in my ass, Joe Boxer said, then crossed his legs and plucked fussily at the crease on his pants.
Junior watched them come from his hiding place inside the Peace Bridge, peeking through a crack in the wall. He was amazed to see so much of the town in the same place at the same time, and gratified by the speakers. He would be able to hear everything from where he was. And once his father got really cranked up, he would make his move. God help anyone who gets in my way, he thought. His father's slope-bellied bulk was impossible to miss, even in the growing gloom. Also, the town hall was fully powered this evening, and light from one of the windows drew an oblong down to where Big Jim stood on the edge of the jam parking lot. Carter Thibodeau was at his side. Big Jim had no sense of being watched. Or rather, he had a sense of being watched by everybody, which comes to the same. He checked his watch and saw it had just gone 7. His political sense, honed over many years, told him that an important meeting should always begin 10 minutes late, no more and no less, which meant this was the time to start down the taxiway. He was holding a folder with his speech inside it, but once he got going, he wouldn't need it. He knew what he was going to say. It seemed to him that he had given the speech in his sleep last night, not once but several times. And each time it had been better. He nudged Carter.
Time to put this show on the road.
Okay.
Carter ran over to where Randolph was standing on the town hall steps. Probably thinks he looks like Julius Cotton picking Caesar, Big Jim thought, and brought the chief back.
We go in the side door, Big Jim said.
He consulted his watch.
4 minutes from now. You'll lead, Peter. I'll go second. Carter, you come behind me. We'll go straight to the stage, all right? Walk confidently, no gosh darn slouching. There'll be applause. Stand at attention until it starts to taper off. Then sit. Peter, you'll be on my left. Carter, on my right. I'll step forward to the podium. Prayer first. Then everybody stands to sing the national anthem. After that, I'll speak and run the agenda just as fast as poop through a goose. They'll vote yay on everything. Got it?
I'm nervous as a witch, Randolph confessed.
Don't be. This is going to be fine.
He was certainly wrong about that. 16. While Big Jim and his entourage were walking toward the side door of the town hall, Rose was turning the restaurant van into the McClatchy driveway. Following her was a plain Chevrolet sedan driven by Joni Calvert. Claire came out of the house holding a suitcase in one hand and a canvas carry bag filled with groceries in the other. Joe and Benny Drake also had suitcases, although most of the clothes in Benny's had come from Joe's dresser drawers. Benny was carrying another, smaller canvas sack loaded with loot from the McClatchy pantry. From down the hill came the amplified sound of applause.
"Hurry up," Rose said. "This is starting. Time for us to get out of Dodge."
Lissa Jameson was with her. She slid open the van's door and began handing stuff inside.
"Is there a lead roll to cover the windows?" Joe asked Rose.
"Yes, and extra pieces for Joni's car as well. We'll drive as far as you say it's safe, then block the windows. Give me that suitcase."
"This is insane, you know," Joni Calvert said.
She walked a fairly straight line between her car and the Sweetbriar van, which led Rose to believe she'd had no more than a single drink or two to fortify herself. That was a good thing.
"You're probably right," Rose said. "Are you ready?"
Joni sighed and put her arm around her daughter's slim shoulders.
"For what, going to hell in a handbasket? Why not? How long will we have to stay up there?"
"I don't know," Rose said.
Joni gave another sigh.
"Well, at least it's warm."
Joe asked Nori, "Where's your gramps?"
"With Jackie and Mr. Burpee in the van we stole from Rennie's. He'll wait outside while they go in to get Rusty and Mr. Barbara."
She gave him a scared-to-death smile.
"He's going to be their wheelman."
"No fool like an old fool," Joni Calvert remarked. Rose felt like hauling off and hitting her, and a glance at Lissa told her that Lissa felt the same. But this was no time for argument, let alone fisticuffs. Hang together or hang separately, Rose thought.
"What about Julia?" Claire asked.
"She's coming, with Piper. And her dog." From downtown, amplified and with the bench sitters outside adding their own voices, came the United Choir of Chester's Mill singing the Star Spangled Banner. "Let's go," Rose said. "I'll lead the way." Joni Calvert repeated with a kind of dolorous good cheer.
"At least it's warm. Come on, Nori, co-pilot your old mom."
17. There was a delivery lane on the south side of Leclerc's Maison des Fleurs, and here the stolen phone company van was parked, nose out. Ernie, Jackie, and Romy Burpee sat listening to the national anthem coming from up the street. Jackie felt a sting behind her eyes and saw that she wasn't the only one who was moved. Ernie, sitting behind the wheel, had produced a handkerchief from his back pocket and was dabbing at his eyes with it.
"Guess we won't need Linda to give us a heads up," Romy said. "I didn't expect them speakers. They didn't get them from me."
"It's still good for people to see her there," Jackie said. "Got your mask, Romy?"
He held up Dick Cheney's visage, stamped in plastic. In spite of his extensive stock, Romy hadn't been able to provide Jackie with an aerial mask. She had settled for Harry Potter's chum, Hermione. Ernie's Darth Vader mask was behind the seat, but Jackie thought they'd probably be in trouble if he actually had to put it on. She had not said this aloud. And really, what does it matter? When we're suddenly not around town anymore, everybody's going to have a good idea why we're gone. But suspecting wasn't the same as knowing, and if suspicion was the best Rennie and Randolph could do, the friends and relatives they were leaving behind might be subjected to no more than harsh questioning. Might. Under circumstances like these, Jackie realized that was a mighty big word. The anthem ended. There was more applause. And then the town's second selectman began to speak. Jackie checked the pistol she was carrying. It was her extra, and thought that the next few minutes were probably going to be the longest of her life. 18. Barbie and Rusty stood at the doors of their respective cells, listening as Big Jim launched into his speech. Thanks to the speakers outside the main doors of the town hall, they could hear pretty well.
"Thank you. Thank you, one and all. Thank you for coming. And thank you for being the bravest, toughest, can-doingest people in these United States of America."
Enthusiastic applause.
"Ladies and gentlemen, and kiddies, too, I see a few of those in the audience."
Good-natured laughter.
"We are in a terrible predicament here, this you know. Tonight I intend to tell you how we got into it. I don't know everything, but I will share what I know because you deserve that. When I finish putting you in the picture, we have a brief but important agenda to go through. But first and foremost, I want to tell you how proud I am of you, how humbled I am to be the man God and you have chosen to be your leader at this critical juncture. And I want to assure you that together we will come through this trial. Together, and with God's help, we will emerge stronger and truer and better than we ever were before. We may be Israelites in the desert now."
Barbie rolled his eyes and Rusty made a jacking-off gesture with his fist.
"But soon we will reach Canaan and the feast of milk and honey which the Lord and our fellow Americans will surely set before us."
Wild applause. It sounded like a standing O. Fairly certain that even if there was a bug down here, the three or four cops upstairs would now be clustered in the PD doorway, listening to Big Jim, Barbie said, "Be ready, my friend."
"I am," Rusty said. "Believe me, I am." Just as long as Linda's not one of them planning to bust in, he thought. He didn't want her killing anyone, but more than that, he didn't want her to risk being killed. Not for him. Let her stay right where she is.
He may be crazy, but at least if she's with the rest of the town, she's safe. That was what he thought before the gunfire started. 19. Big Jim was exultant. He had them exactly where he wanted them, in the palm of his hand. Hundreds of people, those who had voted for him and those who hadn't. He had never seen so many in this hall, not even when school prayer or the school budget was under discussion. They sat thigh to thigh and shoulder to shoulder, outside as well as in, and they were doing more than listening to him. With Sanders AWOL and Grinnell sitting in the audience, that red dress in the third row was hard to miss, he owned this crowd. Their eyes begged him to take care of them, to save them. What completed his exultancy was having his bodyguard beside him and seeing the lines of cops, his cops, ranged along both sides of the hall. Not all of them were kitted out in uniforms yet, but all were armed. At least 100 more in the audience were wearing blue armbands. It was like having his own private army. My fellow townspeople, most of you know that we have arrested a man named Dale Barbara. A storm of boos and hisses arose. Big Jim waited for it to subside, outwardly grave, inwardly grinning. For the murders of Brenda Perkins, Lester Coggins, and two lovely girls we all knew and loved, Angie McCain and Dodie Sanders. More boos, interspersed with cries of "Hang him!" and "Terrorist!" The terrorist shouter sounded like Velma Winter, the day manager at Brownie's store. "What you do not know," Big Jim continued, "is that the dome is the result of a conspiracy perpetrated by an elite group of rogue scientists and covertly funded by a government splinter group. We are guinea pigs in an experiment, my fellow townspeople. And Dale Barbara was the man designated to chart and guide that experiment's course from the inside." Stunned silence greeted this. Then there was a roar of outrage. When it had quieted, Big Jim continued, hands planted on either side of the podium, his large face shining with sincerity and perhaps hypertension. His speech lay in front of him, but it was still folded. There was no need to look at it. God was using his vocal cords and moving his tongue. "When I speak of covert funding, you may wonder what I mean. The answer is horrifying, but simple. Dale Barbara, aided by an as yet unknown number of townspeople, set up a drug manufacturing facility which has been supplying huge quantities of crystal methamphetamine to drug lords, some with CIA connections, all up and down the eastern seaboard. And although he hasn't given us the names of all his co-conspirators yet, one of them, it breaks my heart to tell you this, appears to be Andy Sanders." Hubbub and cries of wonder from the audience. Big Jim saw Andy Grinnell start to rise from her seat, then settle back. "That's right," he thought. "Just sit there. If you're reckless enough to question me, I'll eat you alive. Or point my finger at you and accuse you. Then they'll eat you alive." And, in truth, he felt as if he could do that. "Barbara's boss, his control, is a man you have all seen on the news. He claims to be a colonel in the U.S. Army, but in fact, he is high in the councils of the scientists and government officials responsible for this satanic experiment. I have Barbara's confession to this much right here." He tapped his sport coat, whose inner pocket contained his wallet and a digest-sized New Testament with the words of Christ printed in red. Meanwhile, more cries of "Hang him!" had arisen. Big Jim lifted one hand, head lowered, face grave, and the cries eventually stilled. "We will vote on Barbara's punishment as a town, one unified body dedicated to the cause of freedom. It's in your hands, ladies and gentlemen. If you vote to execute, he will be executed. But there will be no hanging while I am your leader. He will be executed by police firing squad." Wild applause interrupted him, and most of the assembly rose to its feet. Big Jim leaned into the microphone.
but only after we get every bit of information which is still hidden in his miserable traitor's heart. Now almost all of them were up. Not Andy, though. She sat in the third row next to the center aisle, looking up at him with eyes that should have been soft and hazy and confused, but were not. Look at me all you want, he thought, just as long as you sit there like a good little girl. Meanwhile, he basked in the applause. 20.
No, Romy asked. What you think, Jackie?
Wait a little longer, she said. It was instinct, nothing else. And usually her instincts were dependable. Later, she would wonder how many lives might have been saved if she had told Romy, okay, let's roll. 21. Looking through his crack in the sidewall of the Peace Bridge, Junior saw that even the people on the benches outside had risen to their feet, and the same instinct that told Jackie to stay a little longer told him it was time to move. He limped from beneath the bridge on the town common side and cut across to the sidewalk. When the creature who had sired him resumed speaking, he started toward the police department. The dark spot on the left side of his field of vision had expanded again, but his mind was clear.
I'm coming, Barbie. I'm coming for you right now.
22.
These people are masters of disinformation, Big Jim continued. And when you go out to the dome to visit with your loved ones, the campaign against me will kick into high gear. Cox and his surrogates will stop at nothing to blacken me. They'll call me a liar and a thief. They may even say I ran their drug operation myself. You did, a clear, carrying voice said.
It was Andrea Grinnell. Every eye fixed upon her as she rose, a human exclamation point in her bright red dress. She looked at Big Jim for a moment with an expression of cool contempt, then turned to face the people who had elected her third select woman when old Billy Kale, Jack Kale's father, had died of a stroke 4 years ago.
You people need to put your fears aside for a moment, she said. When you do, you'll see that the story he's telling is ludicrous. Jim Rennie thinks you can be stampeded like cattle in a thunderstorm. I've lived with you all my life, and I think he's wrong.
Big Jim waited for cries of protest. There were none. Not that the townspeople necessarily believed her. They were just stunned by this sudden turn of events. Alice and Aiden Appleton had turned all the way around and were kneeling on their benches, goggling at the lady in red. Caro was equally stunned.
A secret experiment? What bullshit! Our government has gotten up to some pretty lousy stuff over the last 50 years or so, and I'd be the first to admit it. But holding a whole town prisoner with some sort of force field? Just to see what we'll do? It's idiotic. Only terrified people would believe it. Rennie knows that. So he's been orchestrating the terror.
Big Jim had been momentarily knocked off his stride, but now he found his voice again. And, of course, he had the microphone.
Ladies and gentlemen, Andrea Grinnell is a fine woman, but she's not herself tonight. She's as shocked as the rest of us, of course, but in addition, I'm sorry to say that she herself has a serious drug dependency problem as a result of a fall and her consequent use of an extremely addictive drug called... I haven't had anything stronger than aspirin for days now, Andrea said in a clear, carrying voice. And I have come into possession of papers which show... Melvin Searles, Big Jim boomed. Will you and several of your fellow officers gently but firmly remove Selectwoman Grinnell from the room and escort her home, or perhaps to the hospital for observation? She's not herself.
There were some approving murmurs, but not the clamor of approbation he'd expected. And Mel Searles had taken only a single step forward when Henry Morrison swept a hand into Mel's chest and sent him back against the wall with an audible thump.
Let's let her finish, Henry said. She's a town official, too, so let her finish.
Mel looked up at Big Jim, but Big Jim was watching Andy, almost hypnotized, as she drew a brown manila envelope from her big bag. He knew what it was the instant he saw it. Brenda Perkins, he thought.
Oh, what a bitch. Even dead, her bitchery continues. As Andy held the envelope up, it began to waver back and forth. The shakes were coming back, the fucking shakes. They couldn't have picked a worse time, but she wasn't surprised. In fact, she might have expected it. It was the stress.
"The papers in this envelope came to me from Brenda Perkins," she said, and at least her voice was steady. "They were compiled by her husband and the state attorney general. Duke Perkins was investigating James Rennie for a laundry list of high crimes and misdemeanors."
Mel looked at his friend Carter for guidance.
And Carter was looking back, his gaze bright and sharp and almost amused. He pointed at Andrea, then held the side of his hand against his throat. "Shut her up." This time when Mel started forward, Henry Morrison didn't stop him. Like almost everyone else in the room, Henry was gaping at Andrea Grinnell. Marty Arsenal and Freddie Denton joined Mel as he hurried along the front of the stage, bent over like a man running in front of a movie screen. From the other side of the town hall, Todd Wendelstadt and Lauren Connery were also in motion. Wendelstadt's hand was on a sawed-off piece of hickory cane he was carrying as a nightstick. Connery's was on the butt of her gun. Andy saw them coming, but didn't stop.
"The proof is in this envelope, and I believe it's proof
that Brenda Perkins died for," she intended to finish. But at that moment, her shaking, sweat-slicked left hand lost her grip on the drawstring top of her bag. It fell into the aisle, and the barrel of her Home Protection 38 slid from the bag's puckered mouth like a periscope. Clearly, heard by everyone in the now silent hall, Aiden Appleton said,
"Wow, that lady has a gun."
Another instant of thunderstruck silence followed. Then Carter Thibodeau leaped from his seat and ran in front of his boss, screaming, "Gun! Gun! Gun!" Aiden slipped into the aisle to investigate more closely.
"No aid!"
Caro shouted, and bent over to grab him just as Mel fired the first shot. It put a hole in the polished wood floor right in front of Carolyn Sturge's nose. Splinters flew up. One struck her just below the right eye, and blood began to pour down her face. She was vaguely aware that everyone was screaming now. She knelt in the aisle, grabbed Aiden by the shoulders, and hiked him between her thighs like a football. He flew back into the row where they'd been sitting, surprised but unhurt.
"Gun! She's got a gun!"
Freddie Denton shouted, and swept Mel out of his way. Later, he would swear that the young woman was reaching for it, and that he had only meant to wound her, anyway. 23. Thanks to the speakers, the three people in the stolen van heard the change in the festivities at the town hall. Big Jim's speech and the accompanying applause were interrupted by some woman, who was talking loudly, but standing too far from the mic for them to make out the words. Her voice was drowned in a general uproar punctuated by screams. Then there was a gunshot.
"What the hell?" Romy said.
More gunshots. Two, perhaps three. And screams.
"Doesn't matter," Jackie said. "Drive, Ernie, and fast. If we're going to do this, we have to do it now."
24.
"No," Linda cried, leaping to her feet. "No shooting. There are children. There are children."
The town hall erupted in pandemonium. Maybe for a moment or two they hadn't been cattle, but now they were. The stampede for the front doors was on. The first few got out, then the crowd jammed up. A few souls who had retained a scrap of common sense beat feet down the side and center aisles toward the exit doors which flanked the stage, but they were a minority. Linda reached for Carolyn Sturges, meaning to pull her back to the relative safety of the benches, when Toby Manning, sprinting down the center aisle, ran into her. His knee connected with the back of Linda's head, and she fell forward, dazed.
"Caro!"
Alice Appleton was screaming from somewhere far away.
"Caro! Get up! Caro! Get up! Caro, get up!"
Carolyn started getting to her feet, and that was when Freddie Denton shot her squarely between the eyes, killing her instantly. The children began to shriek. Their faces were freckled with her blood. Linda was vaguely aware of being kicked and stepped on. She got to her hands and knees, standing was currently out of the question, and crawled into the aisle opposite the one she'd been sitting in, her hands squelched in more of Carolyn's blood. Alice and Aiden were trying to get to Carol, knowing they might be seriously hurt if they made it into the aisle, and not wanting them to see what had become of the woman she assumed was their mother. Andy reached over the bench just ahead of her to grab them. She had dropped the Vader envelope. Carter Thibodeau had been waiting for this. He was still standing in front of Rennie, shielding him with his body, but he had drawn his gun and laid it over his forearm. Now he squeezed the trigger, and the troublesome woman in the red dress, the one who had caused this ruckus, went flying backward. The town hall was in chaos, but Carter ignored it. He descended the stairs and walked steadily to where the woman in the red dress had fallen. When people came running down the center aisle, he threw them out of his way, first left and then right. The little girl, crying, tried to cling to his leg, and Carter kicked her aside without looking at her. He didn't see the envelope at first. Then he did. It was lying beside one of the Grinnell woman's outstretched hands. A large foot track printed in blood had been stamped across the word Vader. Still calm in the chaos, Carter glanced around and saw that Rennie was staring at the shambles of his audience, his face shocked and unbelieving. Good. Carter yanked out the tails of his shirt. A screaming woman, it was Carla Venziano, ran into him, and he hurled her aside. Then he jammed the Vader envelope into his belt at the small of his back and bloused the tails of his shirt out over it. A little insurance was always a good thing. He backed toward the stage, not wanting to be blindsided. When he reached the stairs, he turned and trotted up them. Randolph, the town's fearless chief, was still in his seat with his hands planted on his meaty thighs. He could have been a statue, except for the single vein pulsing in the center of his forehead. Carter took Big Jim by the arm. Come on, boss. Big Jim looked at him as if he did not quite know where or even who he was. Then his eyes cleared a little. Grinnell? Carter pointed to the body of the woman sprawled in the center aisle, the growing puddle around her head matching her dress. Okay, good, Big Jim said. Let's get out of here. Downstairs. You too, Peter. Get up. And when Randolph continued to sit and stare at the maddened crowd, Big Jim kicked him in the shin. Move! In the pandemonium, no one heard the shots from next door. 25. Barbie and Rusty stared at each other.
What the hell is going on over there? Rusty asked.
I don't know, Barbie said, but it doesn't sound good. There were more gunshots from the town hall, then one that was much closer. From upstairs. Barbie hoped it was their guys. And then he heard someone yell,
No, Junior! What are you, crazy? Wardlaw, back me up!
More gunshots followed. Four, maybe five.
Oh, Jesus, Rusty said. We're in trouble.
I know, Barbie said. 26. Junior paused on the PD steps, looking over his shoulder toward the newly hatched uproar at the town hall. The people on the benches outside were now standing and craning their necks, but there was nothing to see. Not for them and not for him. Perhaps someone had assassinated his father. He could hope. It would save him the trouble. But in the meantime, his business was inside the PD. In the coop, to be specific. Junior pushed through the door with, Working together, your hometown police department and you, printed on it. Stacy Moggin came hurrying toward him. Roop Libby was behind her. In the ready room, standing in front of the grumpy sign reading Coffee and Donuts Are Not Free, was Mickey Wardlaw. Hulk or not, he looked very frightened and unsure of himself.
You can't come in here, Junior, Stacy said.
Sure I can.
Sure came out sure. It was the numbness at the side of his mouth.
Thallium poisoning. Barbie.
I'm on a force.
You're drunk is what you are. What's going on over there?
But then, perhaps deciding he was incapable of any coherent reply, the bitch gave him a push in the center of his chest. It made him stagger on his bad leg and almost fall.
Go away, Junior.
She looked back over her shoulder and spoke her last words on earth.
You stay where you are, Wardlaw. No one goes downstairs.
When she turned back, meaning to bulldoze Junior out of the station ahead of her, she found herself looking into the muzzle of a police-issue Beretta. There was time for one more thought, Oh, no, he wouldn't. And then a painless boxing glove hit her between the breasts and drove her backward. She saw Roop Libby's amazed face upside down as her head tilted back. Then she was gone. No, Junior, what are you, crazy? Roop shouted, clawing for his gun. Wardlaw, back me up! But Mickey Wardlaw only stood gaping as Junior pumped 5 bullets into Piper Libby's cousin. His left hand was numb, but his right was still okay. He didn't even need to be a particularly good shot, with a stationary target just 7 feet away. The first 2 rounds went into Roop's belly, driving him against Stacy Moggin's desk and knocking it over. Roop doubled up, holding himself. Junior's 3rd shot went wild, but the next 2 went into the top of Roop's head. He went down in a grotesquely balletic posture, his legs splaying out to either side and his head, what remained of it, coming to rest on the floor, as if in a final deep bow. Junior limped into the ready room with the smoking Beretta held out in front of him. He couldn't remember exactly how many shots he had fired. He thought 7, maybe 8, or 11-9. Who could know for sure? His headache was back. Mickey Wardlaw raised his hand. There was a frightened, placatory smile on his large face.
No trouble for me, bro, he said. You do what you gotta do, and made the peace sign.
I will, Junior said. Bro.
He shot Mickey. The big boy went down, peace sign now framing the hole in his head that had lately held an eye. The remaining eye rolled up to look at Junior with the dumb humility of a sheep in the shearing pen. Junior shot him again, just to be sure. Then he looked around. He had the place to himself, it appeared.
Okay, he said. Okay.
He started toward the stairs, then went back to Stacy Moggin's body. He verified the fact that she was carrying a Beretta Taurus like his and ejected the mag from his own gun. He replaced it with a full one from her belt. Junior turned, staggered, went to 1 knee, and got up again. The black spot on the left side of his vision now seemed as big as a manhole cover, and he had an idea that meant his left eye was pretty much fucked. Well, that was all right. If he needed more than 1 eye to shoot a man locked in a cell, he wasn't worth a hoot in a hen house anyway. He walked across the ready room, slipped in the late Mickey Wardlaw's blood, and almost fell again. But he caught himself in time. His head was thumping, but he welcomed it. It's keeping me sharp, he thought.
Hello, Barbie, he called down the stairs. I know what you did to me, and I'm coming for you. If you've got a prayer to say, better make it a quick one.
27. Rusty watched the limping legs descend the metal stairs. He could smell gun smoke, he could smell blood, and he understood perfectly well that his time of dying had come around. The limping man was here for Barbie, but he would almost certainly not neglect a certain caged physician's assistant on his way by. He was never going to see Linda or the Jays again. Junior's chest came into view, then his neck, then his head. Rusty took 1 look at the mouth, which was dragged down on the left in a frozen leer, and at the left eye, which was weeping blood, and thought, very far gone. A wonder he's still on his feet, and a pity he didn't wait just a little longer and he wouldn't have been capable of crossing the street. Faintly, in another world, he heard a bullhorn amplified voice from the town hall. Do not run. Do not panic. The danger is over. This is Officer Henry Morrison, and I repeat, the danger is over. Junior slipped. But by then he was on the last stair. Instead of falling and breaking his neck, he only went to 1 knee. He rested that way for a few moments, looking like a prize fighter waiting for the mandatory 8 count to rise and resume the bout. To Rusty, everything seemed clear, near, and very dear. The precious world, suddenly grown thin and insubstantial, was now only a single gauze wrapping between him and whatever came next. If anything. Go all the way down. He thought it, Junior. Fall on your face. Pass out, you motherfucker. But Junior laboriously rose to his feet, gazed at the gun in his hand as if he had never seen such a thing before, then looked down the corridor to the cell at the end, where Barbie stood with his hands wrapped around the bars, looking back.
Barbie,
Junior said in a crooning whisper, and started forward. Rusty stepped backward, thinking that perhaps Junior would miss him on his way by, and perhaps kill himself after finishing with Barbie. He knew these were craven thoughts, but he also knew they were practical thoughts. He could do nothing for Barbie, but he might be able to survive himself. And it could have worked, had he been in one of the cells on the left side of the corridor, because that was Junior's blind side. But he had been put in one on the right, and Junior saw him move. He stopped and peered in at Rusty, his half-frozen face simultaneously bewildered and sly.
"Fusty," he said. "Is that your name? Or is it Beric? I can't remember."
Rusty wanted to beg for his life, but his tongue was pasted to the roof of his mouth. And what good would begging do? The young man was already raising the gun. Junior was going to kill him. No power on earth would stop him. Rusty's mind, in its last extremity, sought an escape many other minds had found in their last moments of consciousness. Before the switch was pulled, before the trap opened, before the pistol pressed against the temple spat fire. "This is a dream," he thought, "all of it. The dome, the craziness in Dinsmore's field, the food riot, this young man, too. When he pulls the trigger, the dream will end, and I'll wake up in my own bed, on a cool and crisp fall morning. I'll turn to Linda and say, 'What a nightmare I had. You won't believe it.'"
"Close your eyes, Fusty," Junior said. "It'll be better that way."
28. Jackie Weddington's first thought upon entering the PD lobby was, "Oh, my dear God, there's blood everywhere." Stacy Moggin lay against the wall below the community outreach bulletin board with her cloud of blonde hair spread around her and her empty eyes staring up at the ceiling. Another cop, she couldn't make out which one, was sprawled on his face in front of the overturned reception desk, his legs spread out to either side at an impossibly deep split. Beyond him, in the ready room, a third cop lay dead on his side. That one had to be Wardlaw, one of the new kids on the block. He was too big to be anyone else. The sign over the coffee station table was spattered with the kids' blood and brains. It now read, "K-fee and do are ot free." There was a faint clacking sound from behind her. She whirled, unaware that she had raised her gun until she saw Romy Burpee in the front sight. Romy didn't even notice her. He was staring at the bodies of the three dead cops. The clack had been his Dick Cheney mask. He had taken it off and dropped it on the floor.
"Christ, what happened here?" he asked. "Is this..."
Before he could finish, a shout came from downstairs in the coop. "Hey, fuckface. I got you, didn't I? I got you good." And then, incredibly, laughter. It was high-pitched and maniacal. For a moment, Jackie and Romy could only stare at each other, unable to move. Then Romy said,
"I think that's Barbara."
29. Ernie Calvert sat behind the wheel of the phone company van, which was idling at a curb stenciled "Police Business 10 minutes only." He had locked all the doors, afraid of being carjacked by one or more of the panic-stricken people fleeing down Main Street from the town hall. He was holding the rifle Romy had stowed behind the driver's seat, although he wasn't sure he could shoot anybody who tried to break in. He knew these people, had for years sold them their groceries. Terror had rendered their faces strange, but not unrecognizable. He saw Henry Morrison coursing back and forth on the town hall lawn, looking like a hunting dog searching for scent. He was shouting into his bullhorn and trying to bring a little order out of the chaos. Someone knocked him over, and Henry got right back up, God bless him. And now here were others. Georgie Frederick, Marty Arsenal, the Searles kid, recognizable by the bandage he was still wearing on his head, both Bowie brothers, Roger Killian, and a couple of the other newbies. Freddie Denton was marching down the hall's broad front steps with his gun drawn. Ernie didn't see Randolph, although anyone who didn't know better would have expected the chief of police to be in charge of the pacification detail, which was itself teetering on the edge of chaos. Ernie did know better. Peter Randolph had always been an ineffectual blusterbug, and his absence at this particular snafu circus did not surprise Ernie in the least, or concern him. What did concern him was that no one was coming out of the police department, and there had been more gunshots. These were muffled, as if they'd originated downstairs where the prisoners were kept. not ordinarily a praying fellow, Ernie prayed now that none of the people fleeing the town hall would notice the old man behind the wheel of the idling van, that Jackie and Romy would come out safe, with or without Barbara and Everett. It occurred to him that he could just drive away, and was shocked by how tempting the idea was. His cell phone rang. For a moment he just sat there, not sure of what he was hearing, and then he yanked it off his belt. When he opened it, he saw Joni in the window. But it wasn't his daughter-in-law, it was Nori.
"Grandpa, are you all right?"
"Fine," he said, looking at the chaos in front of him.
"Did you get them out?"
"It's happening right now, honey," he said, hoping it was the truth. "I can't talk. Are you safe? Are you at the place?"
"Yes, Grampy. It glows at night. The radiation belt. The cars glowed, too, but then they stopped. Julia says she thinks it isn't dangerous. She says she thinks it's a fake, to scare people away."